Acme is making your grocery shopping easier than ever. Download the Acme mobile app to find digital deals, earn reward points, or shop for delivery or pickup. Acme, fresh foods, local flavors.
93.3 WMMR, audio on demand, presents the Preston and Steve Show podcast.
A couple of weeks back, my son Carter is in, two of my sons go to Souderton Area High School, and they're active in a few different things at school, and my son Carter is in choir.
Yes.
And he's done it for, he started that in middle school and just fell in love with it, and so he stuck with it, which is great. And it's one of my favorite things, one of my favorite school activities to go to are the choir concerts. They're great. And I never
ones do you hate?
I never really knew that either, because I was a band student in high school. And I didn't go to the choir. We didn't have shows together or anything like that.
You didn't know how good they were.
I didn't know how much fun they were.
Yeah.
Until I started going to them. And because there's not just traditional songs, there's some contemporary songs.
Sure.
There's a musical accompaniment, and there's a cappella, and there's all kinds of different things that they do. And it's a lot of fun. I didn't realize how much fun it was until I started going to these. And now it's my favorite thing to go to. So I went to the most recent, the spring concert for Souderton. And it's funny because the director, who I'm going to introduce in just a moment, made an announcement before they did this song. And she said, we're going to try something out. So I pulled out my phone, and I'm like, I think this is going to be really cool. And so I filmed it, and I'm really glad I did. I was talking about not, spending too much time on the screens when you go to a performance. So I'm like, I want to capture this. And I was so glad that I did. And she had said, I'm not going to tell you what this is, but from the very first word uttered, you're going to know exactly what song this is. Yeah. So let's give it a try. And it was Bohemian Rhapsody, and I was just incredibly impressed. And I came in here and I played it for you guys. You guys
liked it. We loved it.
Played it on, a little bit on the air, posted it on social media.
I had actually had people request me to send them the link, like people that have no association with Souderton, people that had just heard us. I need to have the audio file of that. Yeah.
It's a great school. There are wonderful staff that work there. So I got in touch with the director of the choir, see if they could maybe come in. She said yes, and here they are. We'd like to welcome to the studio Director Teresa Washam and the Souderton High School Advanced Choir.
Thank you so much.
How you doing, Teresa?
Fantastic.
By the way, you know what I noticed? Because at the end of the last concert, it's a farewell. Most of the group here are seniors, and they're leaving, so there's always an exchange of gifts and thank yous and stuff like that.
Yes.
At the concert. And I noticed they just call you Washam.
Yeah, they do.
Is that happen now? Because Mr. Tucker in the band department, he's just Tucker as well.
Yeah. It's just to show their love.
Yeah.
That's what it is. Yep.
So when they key your car, that's to show love?
Hey, Washam. Do you like that? So do me a favor, because you had mentioned that you've had this arrangement for a little while, this
yes.
song,
mm-hmm.
but it hasn't found the right fit until now.
Exactly. We've tried it on a couple of different choirs, and there are some really tricky parts. It goes into 8-part harmony, and they have to pretend they're a guitar at times, and it just never really worked.
So you needed a level of ability that you hadn't had up to this point.
True.
And now you have it.
I was a doubter. I mean, they asked me at the beginning of the year if they could do it. And I said, well, if you learn all of your other music, then we'll pull it out.
How much additional work did this involve, adding this to the roster?
Well, we only threw it together about the last 3 weeks before the concert.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Was it all you worked on?
Yeah.
Okay. Because it didn't sound that way.
Yeah. This is a group of talented kids.
Wow.
Yeah.
I didn't even know how you begin to work on something like that, because there's so many different parts.
We started with the hardest part.
Oh, really?
The waiting.
Yeah.
So that operatic, the middle part,
yes.
And you started on that first.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
And then you realized that they could indeed handle it.
Yeah. They were determined.
Yeah. Because really the part determined. Where it's, let me go, that has got to be a tricky little segment.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
I don't know. I think we could do it.
Well, what you probably don't know is we all have an a cappella group called the River Valley Vocal Band.
I've actually heard you.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Our voice coach is Justin Timberlake. But
it's Justin Guarini, man.
No, it's Justin Timberlake.
Oh, it is?
Yeah.
Just changed?
Yeah, it just changed. But you're right. It's Justin Guarini. But, we don't want to eclipse this. So, please, you proceed.
By the way, who are the two solos in this particular song? Because we'll point them out.
They're both seniors. Kyle Ryan starts it off, and then Sam Micah takes over.
Would one of them mind if Kathy stepped in and actually did the part?
And said, would you guys give it up? Don't destroy the original.
I think they would mind.
on the horrific second take, yes.
Kathy so badly wanted to be in select choir.
Listen, we tell this story every time we have somebody that comes in and sing, but I really wanted to be in that select choir, and I tried out, you know, year after year, and finally my mom called the music teacher and was like, she really wants to do this, and the woman was like, okay, no problem, and I went and tried out, and I still didn't get it.
Miss Romano, she stinks. She's horrible.
Pretty much.
Let me ask you, because that's got to be really, really hard. Singing in front of people, especially by yourself, and I would imagine you have to do that for auditions, is really a difficult thing to do. But it's got to be really hard to tell somebody that they just don't have it as well. And you have to do that, right?
I do. It's the hardest part of my job. It really is. You feel like you're breaking these kids' hearts.
Yeah. It's tough. I can imagine. But, you know, it comes with the territory.
Yes.
All right. People are waiting.
Let's do it.
Without further ado, we want you guys to hear this. I'm excited. So we have the Souderton Area High School Advanced Choir here under the tutelage and direction of Teresa Washam. And this is Bohemian Rhapsody. Here we go on MMR.
Is this the real life? Is this just fantasy? Caught in a landslide. No escape from reality. Open your eyes. Look up to the sky. Killed a man, put a gun against his head, pulled my trigger, now he's dead. Mama, life had just begun, but now I've gone and thrown it all away. Mama. If I'm not back again this time tomorrow, carry on, as if nothing really matters. Too late, my time has come. Send shivers down my spine. Body's aching all the time. Goodbye, everybody. I've got to go. Gotta leave you all behind and face the truth. Mama.
Easy come, easy go. Will you let me go?
Bismillah.
No, we will not let you go. Let him go.
Bismillah.
We will not let you go. Let him go.
Bismillah.
We will not let you go.
Let me go.
We will not let you go.
Never, 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 never let me go.
No, 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 no,
no. Oh, mama.
Mamma mia, mamma mia, mamma mia, let me go. Beelzebub has the devil put aside for me, for me, for me. Bow, 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 bow.
Wow. I turned my microphone off there. It was Souderton Area High School, their advanced choir, Bohemian Rhapsody. What I tell you.
So yeah, good. Damn good. Yeah, I can see why it's intricate.
There's a ton of texts that came in, and this one says, I think all the listening areas are singing along right now. My whole construction site is at the top of their lungs.
That's awesome.
So that's awesome.
So the first kid who was singing lead, his name is Kyle.
Yep.
His father is my fraternity brother. We graduated college together. So what's up, Tim? Also, Super Dave and Stalker both say you guys sounded amazing.
Super Dave and Stalker.
Okay.
Stalker's that guy's. Tim's last name is Stalker, but we just go by Stalker.
Someday let's hear the story. I'm
yeah,
about
Stalker.
Stalker.
Yeah, yeah. It's because he stalked people.
Right.
Yeah. No, his last name is Stalker.
Okay, all right. Yeah.
Well, that's really cool. That's impressive. You know what? And what I find is interesting is that so you have the concert and you just do two performances of that song right there. Are those the only performances?
Well, we're going to go out to the Satterton School District elementary schools and middle schools.
Okay.
We'll sing it for them. It's kind of a recruitment thing. We go out and the kids look at these guys and say, I want to be just like them someday.
That's yeah. cool. Well, let me ask you. So you have a lot of people leaving, obviously, because they're seniors.
Yeah.
But is there still, in your mind, is there, besides Bohemian Rhapsody, another... Mount Everest to climb
yeah.
and singing. What will be next to try?
Ooh, that's a good question. As far as rock music goes?
Whatever. Anything that the kids have come to you and said, we should do this, and you're like,
give it a shot.
Oh, boy, that's going to be hard.
I mean, this is certainly one of the most complex,
I think of, like,
vocally.
Harmonious stuff from, like, ELO.
Yeah.
Maybe Knights in White Satin.
Ooh.
Perhaps Sweet Judy Blue Eyes by Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young.
The ELO call is a really good one.
Yeah.
Mr. Blue Sky
would be good.
You ever hear that one?
You know what I think is cool is that this song in particular, it stood the test of time.
It has.
And that kids, high school kids, want to do that song. I mean, it's from the 1970s, you know, and it's still got that much oomph to it.
Absolutely.
But this is what they do. They break out these really cool contemporary songs. You're like, oh, man, you know, Dust in the Wind or something like that.
there you go.
The middle school did that. I'm just getting into the high school side of things. But
well, the movie, you know, the Queen movie that's coming out focuses, obviously, clearly in the trailer, focuses in on the creation of the song Bohemian Rhapsody.
Yeah, and how they're like, wait, you want to do what?
Yeah.
And it turns out to be this iconic song that's lasted this long. You guys want to do one more? You guys cool with that?
Sure.
We do.
You want to do that one again? Because that was really good.
Well, we have another song, Lennon McCartney, Imagine.
Oh, all right. Wow. Now, this made me cry.
Yeah.
When you guys did this at the concert.
Yeah.
Could you see him crying from where you were?
I was on the mezzanine.
Okay.
So she could hear me. It was echoing through the theater, so. You guys did such a great version of it. You think you'd be cool to do that?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. All right. So they weren't prepared for this. They were going to come and do one song, but
you threw a curveball.
Yeah.
All right. But they can do it.
Let's do it.
We've got five soloists in this song. Can I just announce their names?
Yeah, please do.
It starts off with Leah Aldifer. Second soloist is Emma Bench. And then we have, who's third? KK Hershey. And then Nick Marateo, and ends with Sam Micah.
Okay.
All right.
So are they rearranging positions because of the solos? Okay.
This song has to be done in height order, Nick.
Oh, it is. Okay. Very technical.
All right. Let's do this one more time. This is the Souderton Area High School Advanced Choir on MMR.
Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell below us. Above us only sky.
Da-da.
Imagine there's no countries. It isn't hard to do. Nothing to kill or die for. And no religion to.
Brotherhood of man.
Da, 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 da,
da, da, da,
da, da, da, da, da, sharing all the world.
You
may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm
crying, Preston.
Oh, I held it together this
you
time.
Did?
You peed a little.
But here's a text that says, ugly crying in my car by the third doo-doo-doo. So a lot of great reaction. If you're just joining the Souderton Area High School Advanced Choir, they impressed the hell out of me. So wanted to see if they could come in. They're getting ready to wrap up the school year. Thought this might be kind of fun, and but you might enjoy it as well.
When you go to see, do they close off the whole mezzanine just for you?
They should. Yeah, of course. I've got a private box up there.
It's like you're like Lincoln up there.
Mm-hmm, yep. Listen, but what I'd like to do is I would like to urge the people in, no matter what community you are in, to number one, support the arts, and number two, you probably have a great choir like this right in your backyard, and you may not even know about
it's
it.
That's true.
Mm-hmm. If you go to your local high school and find out when the concerts are, go to them. You will be mightily impressed by these young people.
Well, you hear how much work they're putting into it.
Absolutely.
And, you know, why not celebrate it?
Yep, most definitely.
And if you can't get in, have your mom call the school.
Yeah. Yeah. Over and over.
She's very talented, and she's beautiful, too.
Teresa, can you rattle off all the seniors' names
real quick? Raise your hands. Amanda Frattarelli, Sarah Roos, Emma Ford, Emily Afflerback, Alfrey Stevens, Michaela Hershey, Kyle Ryan, Kelsey Gleaston, Stephanie Zhang. Who's back there? Sam Crott, Leah Alderfer, Tim Kennel, Sam Micah, and Derek Bowes.
Dear God, I can't believe you can remember all
of them. That's why I could never be a teacher. I can never forget it. You, the one with the brown hair.
I love it. Well, congratulations. A great group. And you guys are amazing. Thank you for being
here
this morning.
Thank you so much for having us. This was a blast.
Appreciate it. Let's hear it for Teresa Washington. Advanced Choir. We're going to take a quick break. We will come back in just a moment. Make sure you stay with us.
This 93.3 WMMR audio on demand program returns after a brief word from our sponsors.
Hey, what's up? It's Preston. Listen, I'd like to thank Jack Frost Mountain for sponsoring today's podcast. Jack Frost and Big Boulder ski areas are officially open for the season. And WMMR's Day Up on the Slopes with Pierre Jackson is January 4th. Tickets are available now at WMMR.com while supplies last. JFBB, where the snow comes first.
If you love paying for shipping, you're going to hate Steven Singer. Free shipping both ways, making return and exchanges easy. Visit him online at IHateStevenSinger.com or at the other corner of 8th and Walnut. Steven Singer Jewelers. One place, one price.
Hey, it's Preston. Listen, I'd like you to make it a perfectly personal new year with our friends at Hannah Still. Make it personal. Make it about you. You spent enough time over the holidays thinking about everybody else. Let's think about you now. There's over 50 locations of Hand and Stone Massage and Facial Spa in Delaware, South Jersey, Philadelphia, the Lehigh Valley, and the spa services start at just $59.95. Take a look at what I'm talking about. Hand and Stone Massage and Facial Spa. Go to handandstone.com today.
This is the Preston and Steve Show podcast.
Our next guest, I want to start by telling you a story over the weekend real quick here. We at my daughter's elementary school, we have this thing called the lip sync competition. Everybody comes out and they put on these little skits, and the parents do an act as well.
Yeah.
So we did the parent act and we had a great time. And after it was over, we have an after party at my house. All the parents come over that were in the parent act. They bring their kids and everything. So there's like 60 people in my house, and I've got a nice sound system in the house. So I put on some music and we're all drinking and eating, having a good time and everything. And the moment that the party switched gears because I have a party mix of music that was rolling on my phone. But the moment that the party switched gears and you could feel it was, you got it, Casey?
Yeah.
Was when this song came on. The very moment that this came on, we took it to another level. I reach over my phone and I just crank it all the way up, and the party just... Everybody jumping. I'm like, all right, man. And the man responsible for making my party a success is here, Daryl McDaniels, DMC. Yeah. Up Run DMC. How you doing, man?
Hello. Good morning. Good morning. Good to be here. What's up, Philly?
I want to say, dude, you look in phenomenal shape, by
the
way.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I feel good. I feel really good. Excellent. Feeling really good right now.
Both Preston and I did a fair amount of just background reading on you because I was always a fan. But what a life, man. And to be in this good a shape right now and to be
I stopped drinking them 40 ounces.
Yeah.
That'll help a lot, everybody out there listening.
Please help me.
Leave the 40s alone.
The rumor was, and I don't know if this is very valid, but like 8 to 10 a day?
No, a case.
A case?
A 40? No. What?
I was
salt liquor.
Yes.
How did you never end up with an endorsement?
Hey, right. I know. I had
forget
an old
Billy
English
D.
ring. I took the bottle cap of old English ring to the jeweler.
Wow.
I had an old English diamond ring.
Wow.
I had an old English tire cover.
Wow.
And check this out. in my SUV, I put a refrigerator so I didn't have to pull over at the grocery stores to get out to get them.
Dude, wow.
I was drinking a case a day, man. I ended up with acute pancreatitis and almost died.
Oh, yeah, that'll kill you. It'll kill you. The drunkest I might have ever been in my life, and I only drank four. Actually, I think there were 45s of Mickey's.
Right, Mean Green.
And, I mean, that was a bad night for me. Mm-hmm. I couldn't imagine doing 20.
I was doing a case a day and then going out at night and partying.
Wow.
And that was, you know, it was what, rum and coke, screwdrivers, fuzzy navels. It was crazy.
Wait, so when you have pancreatitis, does that go away then? Or do you still have it?
No, it goes away.
It goes away.
But fortunately, my pancreas healed. The doctor said I was a miracle.
Wow.
The doctor said I was a miracle.
The fact that you're in this kind of shape after all that is amazing. But, I mean, now, obviously you have a long career and we're going to go through a lot of it.
Yeah.
But the fact that it seemed to me that with all that going on, you still managed to show up and get to the show and do all
stuff. Yeah, I was a functional drunk.
And that's actually a worse scenario. If it had impacted you earlier, you might have jumped on it earlier, but you were able to conduct what you needed to do and still drink.
Yeah, exactly. It was very functional.
Man, wow.
Did you ever play Edward Forty Hands?
No, what is it?
So you take two 40s and you tape them to your hands, and allowed to stop drinking until you're not allowed to take them off until you've emptied the 40s.
Really?
Yeah, it's a great game. Yeah, especially for a recovering alcoholic.
Yes, like a lot of fun. I need to try that again. For a minute, because I got to revisit that. I've never did that. I did everything you possibly can with a 40 ounce.
Yeah.
Except Edward 40 hands.
How were your rapping skills when you were? I mean, because it affects your speech, obviously, but. Did it?
Well, no. When I did a show, when I was touring and stuff like that, I probably was, by the show time, I probably was probably up to like the 740 or whatever.
Jeez.
But you got to understand something. In the 80s, everybody was drinking 40s.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
I just drunk more than everybody. So, you know, sonically, it was sounding like everybody else was sounding anyway.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? But my excess was, I've been sober 14 years now.
Congratulations.
Yeah. When I went to rehab to stop drinking, but then in rehab, I found the most powerful thing a person can do, especially you men, therapy.
Yeah.
I was diagnosed with suppressed emotions. I was using the alcohol to suppress how I really felt about the world.
You were self-medicated.
I was when Down Went the King came out in 93, I was getting ready to kill myself.
Wow.
Yes.
Wow. So
I can relate to where Chester and Chris was at.
Okay.
I'm sick and tired of the pain and the hurt. I do it for Chester, Chris, and Kurt. Death is appealing. With death, I flirt. I tell you how I feel and you think I'm a jerk. I'm not bugging, I'm struggling. All this guzzling is puzzling. So I stop hanging with Jack and Jim to fight in the battle that we all can win.
Yeah.
Love that.
Damn, dude.
Yeah, I was going to jump. I was going to shoot myself. I was going to drink the poison.
How close did you get?
I was getting ready to jump, but then I heard Sarah McLachlan's Angel Song.
Yeah, we were reading about this.
Yeah, I didn't care about nothing, money, fortune, fame, life, nothing. I heard Angel and said, oh, my God, it's beautiful to be alive. And all I did for 1 year was just sit in a room and listen to Sarah McLachlan.
Wow.
Because when you depressed, you're looking for that thing. Depression is about feeling.
Yeah.
So material wealth, sex, physical attraction, money, none of that means anything if you don't feel right.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And I realized that if you don't admit how you feel, whether good or bad, you'll never heal. See, the stigma with depression and anxiety and all these mental health issues is this. If I say, I feel like $1 million today, I can take on the world, I feel great, we celebrate that. But the minute you say, I feel depressed, get away from him, he's a weirdo.
No, you're right. So, and to that point therapy and going to a therapist, I've gone a couple times in my life, and I would...
I tell people, the therapist don't help you. So they say, why do you go? The therapist is a decoy.
Yeah.
So you could do two things. Repeat to yourself stuff you said to yourself that you didn't listen to.
Yeah.
Or start saying stuff to yourself. Forget all this outside stuff. You got to look at yourself and say, what is it that makes me happy?
You're exactly right.
So I found out when I got out of therapy, What makes you happy, D? What makes you the most powerful entity on the microphone and not just in hip-hop?
Yeah.
I'm talking about when I step to the comic books.
Yeah.
I replace the confidence and enthusiasm and excitement about creativity that I got from comic books as a little kid with the old English because I was trying to live up to other people's expectations. I was trying to live up to Run and Jay's expectations and Russell's expectations, and I was doing stuff that I really wouldn't have never did.
So as a kid, you were always into the comic books?
All I did was read, draw, and collect comic books. I never wanted to be in show business. I have so much anxiety sitting here in front of y'all talking to y'all.
Really?
Yeah, because when hip-hop...
But you're such a natural at it.
But that's after 30 years of practice.
Okay, all right.
When hip-hop first came into Queens from the Bronx in New York, I didn't look at it as a money opportunity show, but I was like, oh, shoot, you can tell stories about who you are over music.
Mm-hmm.
So listen, this is the truth. My whole career, all I was doing was pretending to be the most powerful entity in the hip-hop universe.
Right.
I was looking to be Mighty Thor on a microphone. Okay. One day I sat there and said, okay, Thor is the son of Odin from Asgard. He got a brother named Loki, and he has a hammer. And I'm Daryl from Hollis. My father's name is Byford. His father's name is Odin. And I'm from Hollis, and I got a mic. So the microphone thing was... I was pretending to be son of Byford, brother of Al. Banner's my mother and Run's my pal. It's McDaniels, not McDonald's. These rhymes are Daryl's. Those burgers are Ronald's. I ran down my family tree. My mother, my father, my brother, and me. Hip-hop and rock and roll was a creative outlet for me to express what was inside of me. If I never had comic books... Run would have never discovered I was rocking rhymes.
Wow. So right now you have your own. You
graphic
are.
Novel,
you are.
Yes.
You
I'm are the new Stan Lee.
You're the new Stan Lee.
Stan Lee created a monster. And I met Stan. We hang together. I know him very well. And he can't believe it because when I was a kid growing up in New York City, comic books not only took me away from the stress and struggles of, you know, getting bullied and teased. Like,
yeah.
I wore glasses my whole youth.
Yeah.
Until I rhymed about it on my record as being cool. D's for doing it all of the time. M's for the rhymes, that on mine. C's for cool, cool ass can be. Rhymes say, why you wear those glasses? I would go, so I can see. Not to look good, not to be fashionable. If I didn't wear them, I was blind. But before that, my whole life was, hey, four eyes. Hey, binoculars. Hey, yeah. Spectacles. So I was a little kid that went to Catholic school that read comic books that was on the honor roll and the Brainiac. Those things wasn't cool. Hip-hop empowered me to transform from my old man or Daryl McDaniels. Yeah. And then the whole depression thing was crazy, too, because I'm in the midst of my depression. Sarah McLachlan's record is the only if Sarah McLachlan's record, Angel, would have been taking away from this universe, I'd have died. But in the midst of that, check this out. It goes even deeper. After that, I found out at age 35 that I was adopted.
Yeah.
Oh, no
and
way.
Didn't
you didn't know until 35?
You were put into the foster program, right?
Yeah. Oh, but nobody wanted to tell me. Mm-hmm. See, that's some superhero stuff.
That is. It really is.
It was like, Daryl, sit down. We have to tell you. You're really not from here, and you're from another planet.
You're from Krypton.
Yeah, no, it's a whole Superman thing. Yeah, so
that's a whole other level that I had no idea.
And in the midst of all that, I realized that when anything anybody in this world is going through, I don't care what it is, sexual abuse, mental health issues, finding out you're adopted, foster kid, homeless, orphan, whatever it is, if you remove the guilt and shame, you remove the pain.
Yeah.
So that's why I'm here in Philly working with the Philadelphia Sixers. I was one of those kids. For all of these youths that the Philadelphia 76ers touched here in central Philadelphia and Camden, yeah. Our situations doesn't define who we are.
Yeah.
I had no idea that this little adopted kid who was formerly a foster kid would grow up to be the king of rock. There is none higher. I had no idea with that. But why did that happen? Because outside of our blood relationships, outside of all of our blood relationships, there's people put on this earth to help us get where we're supposed to go, regardless of who we are. Now, I met my birth mother.
How old were you when that happened?
I was 30-something, yeah. I met my birth mother. I found out I was adopted in 2000, and I found my birth mother in 2004. And when I met her, she said, I know you're dying to know why I gave you up. And I was like, shoot, lady, that's an understatement.
Yeah.
And she looked me in my eyes and she said, I gave you up to give you a chance.
Wow. Did you, when you heard that, because this is a fascinating thing for all of us.
Right.
You know, I'd always had my parents and loving, and it was great. But I always thought of the notion, what would I say? What would I ask? And would that answer, if that was the answer, would I accept that or would I still hold bitterness?
Well, I wasn't bitter until I met other adoptees.
Okay.
Because it was like a secret. When I found out that I was adopted, all my cousins, because, you know, Christmas time in Hollis, Queens, Mom's cooking chicken, and every time there was something for our family to do, 4th of July, Christmas, birthdays, New Year's, it was always at the McDaniels house. So I had a lot of little cousins when I was growing up. When it was found out that Daryl finally knows, they all called me. And they would say, oh, dear, we've been holding that secret in for 39 years, this and that. And
so all my little cousins.
Yeah, what would happen was, we're going over to McDaniel's house for the 4th of July cookout. We're going over to McDaniel's house for Christmas. We're going over to McDaniel's house for New Year's. Kids, come into the living room, sit down. What's the rule? Nobody let Daryl know he's adopted.
Wow.
Because they thought if they were revealed my truth to me, it might have did something to keep me. My mother and father, I was one of the last foster kids to be in my house. I remember a lot of cousins that I had growing up that left and never came back.
Yeah.
Nobody never came back to get me. So my mother and father said, what are we going to do with this one? Let's keep him. So they kept me. But they didn't want, and I was a straight-A student, elementary, straight-A student through high school, made it to St. John's University. They was thinking if they would tell me my truth, it was going to ruin me.
Yeah.
But it ruined me anyway by thinking there was something wrong about telling me my truth. I was functioning like a normal kid, but since I was functioning like a normal kid, but I had this truth, secret identity about me, they didn't tell me that. So by trying to treat me normal, they was treating me different, which affects my normal. You know what I'm saying? It was crazy. Yeah, yeah.
I want to follow up on that because that goes along with depression. You know, being a foster kid is almost equivalent to being depressed. And I don't want to dwell on a negative topic,
I think that it's
a part of your identity.
Yes.
And I've heard, and I heard this TED Talk recently that suggested that in the African American community, it's even more difficult to talk about depression and anxiety.
Oh, for sure.
It gets buried. So so what you're doing
because
with the Sixers,
because they don't think it's masculine and strong.
Exactly. You got to be a tough, strong black man on top of being a tough person.
And all the people in hip-hop and all these gangster dudes are fronting.
Yeah.
In reality, they're soft. You know, and what happened was the mighty King of Rock admitted that he goes to therapy and he was depressed and he was alcoholic and he went to get help. That's changing some people's lives because they were all ashamed. And it was like, don't say nothing because Daryl adopted. I'm not ashamed of my situation. Like, if I was born in a telephone booth and can't find my parents, I'm going to talk about that.
Yeah.
Because that's part of my identity. That's part of my... My therapist said what happened was this. Prior to me... I had to stop drinking because of pancreatitis in 91. So that was the universe setting me up for what was coming.
Right.
So from 91 all the way up to when I found out I was adopted, it was all cold turkey. But when I found out I was adopted, I started drinking again. Mm. And my wife, I love women because y'all write all the time. My wife, women are very intuitive.
Yes.
I say I'm drinking because I've found the new celebration of my identity. My wife looked me in my face and said, Emma Effa, you're drinking because you can't emotionally handle the fact that you're really adopted. And when she said that to me, it was truth, but I was trying to drink. I was trying to use that. So once I found out that I was adopted, everything started to make sense because in 1993, when we put out Down with the King, Pete Rock and CL Smooth. Remember, in the 90s, hip hop had changed.
Yes, it had. Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? We were still respected.
Yep.
Pioneers, legends, but nobody cared. So in 93, Pete Rock produces Down with the King. And I came with the lyric, taking the tours, I'm wrecking the land. I keep it hardcore because it's dope, man. These are the roughest, toughest words I ever wrote. And not meant for like a slow jam. Sucker MCs can never swing with T because of all the things that I bring with me. Only G.O.D. could be a king to me. And if the G.O.D. be in me, then a king I'd be. So everybody bowed.
Wow, yeah.
When everybody started bowing and praising us and they put me and Running Jay on the throne, I laid in my bed. We started touring again. Well, the Paydays was bigger in the 90s. We're back on the charts. 93, we're back on the charts with two, and we did shows with Tupac and Biggie and Diddy and everybody. I would get off stage and go to my bedroom, and I'd lay down. I don't want to live no more. Oof. I want to die. And I just said this, okay, something in me was empty. And I laid down. I said, okay, let me get this straight. I'm Daryl McDaniels from Hollis, Queens, New York. Byford and Banner is my mother and father. Alf is my brother. Run and Jay are my friends. This thing called hip-hop comes over the bridge. Me and Run make one record, one single, it was a hit. Then we made another single, it was a hit. Then Russell gets a grand idea. We're going to make an album. So we did the album with Rockbox, which was made us the first rap group on MTV. Yeah. Then the next year, we did a record called King of Rock and All the Rockers. Mm-hmm. Everybody, black people hated us. We never got the cover of Jet. Yeah, they were scared of us because we looked like drug dealers.
Okay.
You know, but we never got the cover of Jet and Ebony, but Rolling Stone and Spin Magazine saluted us. Bon Jovi and Cher and all the rockers loved us because we had the balls to say that we were the kings of rock. Like, what is rap not? But they loved us because of that. You know what I'm saying? We did the King of Rock video with us going into a fictional Rock and Roll Hall of Fame museum that didn't exist in 85 with Larry Bud Melman at the door.
From the Letterman show.
You guys can't come in here. This is a rock and roll museum. Then in 86, we do My Adidas. We get the Adidas deal. And then we do the phenomenal, life-changing, world-changing, not just music, Walk This Way. And I've sung, that song right there.
How did that come about? Because That was a pivotal moment for MTV, for two forms of music.
Right.
How did that end up happening?
It was it wasn't deliberate. It wasn't this. This is the one we recreated. The original Walk This Way on the Toys in the Attic, we was going to sample it.
Okay.
And me and Run, it wasn't going to do this.
Yeah.
It wasn't going to do that.
Right.
It was going to be that beat, and it was going to be, I'm DMC in the place to be. I've been rocking on a mic since 83. I'm the best MC in history. There will never be an MC better than me. And Run was supposed to go, I'm DJ Run, and I'm number one here to get it done. Da-na-na-na. We're supposed to rap about how good we are. So at the time, Rick Rubin was working with us. So we already had this record sampled and looped, ready to put our rhymes on it. And Rick Rubin comes in the studio. I know y'all know Rick Rubin.
Yes,
hey,
legend.
Guys. You know when he talks, he does this. Why does this happen?
I just need to interject.
You ever see him do that?
He talks.
You know what you should do? And we're like, what, Rick? He said, you should do the record over. He ain't have the beard yet, but his hair would move and everything. I'm like, why is this guy nodding every time he talks? So we was thinking from a limited hip-hop capacity. Rick, what the hell you think we're going to do? We're going to sample and we're going to rhyme over it. He says, no. You should do the record over the way the band originally did it. So Jam Master Jay, rest in peace, Jay goes, yo, that might be a Grammy. Hold up. Stop. Wait. Stop. Turn the music up. Shut up. Yo, me and Run's like this. Y'all taking this rock and roll stuff too far, man. We got Rock Box. We got King of Rock. We supposed to come with something awesome. This and that. So with a little reluctance, they convinced us to do it. So me and Run had to take the – listen, I never
How much of a fight did you put up?
A big fight. It took us a week to come back to the studio to do it. Because Rick says, because remember, when a DJ would spin it for us to freestyle, they would never let the vocals play.
Yeah.
As soon as it went, back to the beginning.
Yep.
So Rick takes the record, the vinyl record, off the turntable, says, here, go in D's basement, put the record on the turntables. They still exist. You know, the long yellow notepads.
Right, yeah, Leo pads.
It's been around since the dinosaur. He said, sit there, let the record play, and write out the lyrics. So me and Ron go in my basement. We put the needle on the record, and it went like this. You know, with the dust. Yeah. We sitting there, you know, eager to see what's going to happen. It says, backstroke lover, his voice has come on. We on the phone. Hell no! This is hillbilly gibberish. This is country punk and mountain music. We are not doing this. Y'all are bugging. For one whole week, me and Run hit out from him.
You hit?
The only thing that got us in the studio was a week later, the very next Sunday, a week later, Jay calls. And the whole week, every time we would, the phone would ring, I go to Run because we were scared to pick it up because we knew it was them. We didn't have
your ID and
all that. So you're running, this is me. The whole week, every time me and Run was together, you pick it up. No, you pick it up. You pick it up. That's money for the whole week. So finally on Sunday, I pick up the phone and it was Jay. yo, guys, what's up? And as soon as Jay started speaking, you can hear Russell. Russell Simmons, Run's brother, in the background. Joey, you MIF and this and that. And stupid-ass Daryl, you follow. So Jay goes, yo, Russell, stop screaming. You know these stupid little kids, they never going to come. So Jay says, hey, guys, listen to this. Yeah, where y'all at? We in the studio, and this was the kicker. Rick done went to Boston and brought Steven Tyler and Joe Perry here to the studio. And Jay was using psychology. And he was like, yo, Steven's in the studio busting your ass on your own record.
Whoa.
So me and Run said, but Jay, we can come in. Jay said, come out. Jay goes, yo, come to the studio and do the records the way Run DMC would do it. What you remember? What you talking about?
Yeah, different strokes.
What you talking about? What you talking about, Jay-Z? He said, yo, you know how you switch off and go back and forth? All right, Jay, we gonna come. But so we get to the studio, and I never forget. We finally get to the studio, and we walk in, and Steve and Joe is like standing in the hallway, going into the to the control room. So me and Run walk in. True story. I go, oh shoot, it's the Rolling Stones. That's all out we do. People was connecting with you.
That's it.
But
yeah.
Steve took it lightly. Steve was funny. Rick's Steve said no. He puts his arm on Steve. You know how he does
it.
Those are the other guys. He says, we're Aerosmith. And that kind of like broke the ice. And then we went in and we made the record. But the funny thing is this, and this is what the message to all the kids that you're working with, this is the message to young people. Always be open to do something different and try something new, because it might not just change your life, it could change the world. We finished the Walk This Way that you just heard.
Mm-hmm.
So Russell, Leo Cohen, Steve Plotnicki, Corey Robbins, all our publicists and the whole record label in it, they're celebrating like, yo, this is going to be great. So me and Run thinking we have power. We look at them, we give them 5 minutes. They all happy. So we thought we actually have power. We go, look, y'all can be happy as you want, but y'all better never put this record out as a single. So when the Raising Hell album dropped, the original singles on Raising Hell was My Adidas and Peter Piper.
Yeah.
They white labeled Walk This Way.
What's that mean?
You send it without writing on it. So they sent Walk This Way to all the rock stations, but they also sent it to all the urban stations, the black stations.
Which is brilliant.
Which is brilliant, because this is what happened right after that. We on a Raising Hell tour. We can't understand why the album's selling so good. So we come back to New York. We got a couple of days off. And DJ Red Alert, legendary hip-hop DJ out of New York City, he goes, I'm about to play the best rap song ever. So me and Run knew it was going to be My Adidas, or Peter Piper Pick Peppers. This dude throws on Walk This Way. And all the black people in New York City accepted it. That's the whole story.
Now, do you like the song? Or at the time, did you like it?
No, okay. I love it. I love the song because I'm a rockhead. I never liked Michael Jackson. I live in like Motown. I was a comic book kid nerd. So Marvin Gaye and Al Green, they sung about girls. Girls were yucky to me.
By the way, Daryl's wearing an AC/DC shirt.
Yeah. All I listen to is classic rock and alternative and metal.
And you have
big shout out to Lemmy.
Some collaborations with other artists, which I'll talk about in a minute, but let me ask about Walk This Way again. So so Aerosmith wrote that song. They wrote the lyrics, the melody, all that stuff. So did they get all that?
They get all the credit. We don't get nothing off it.
Oh, man.
Except what now?
And the heat. You got the heat.
People say we brought Aerosmith back, and Steve and Joe admitted it. Yeah, we did something great. The joke is they had that album. See, this is what people forget. They had that album with Dude Looks Like a Lady and Angel. Brilliant album.
That was after, though, was it not?
What album dropped after that? They had that. Studio recording that album that they dropped right after that.
That wouldn't have taken off without this reintroducing
Aerosmith.
Yeah, their
problem was this. Remember I said in 93, nobody cared, but they still respected us? Aerosmith's problem was nobody cared. Here's the joke. They could have made a record with God.
Yeah.
And had Jesus on the drum and Moses playing guitar. Everybody went, nope, it's fake. That's how far gone they were. When Rick called them, the story goes, Rick called, their offices. Hello, I'm Rick Rubin. I'm producing Run DMC, and I want to remake Aerosmith. Where the guys do it? Huh? Who? My name is Rick Rubin. So they go, put Rick on. Hold on. Hey, guys, some guy named Rick Rubin is on the phone saying he wants Run DMC to do the record. Do y'all want to do it? And they was in there working on an album, Steve and Joe, and they was like, what do we got to lose? So they came and did it.
It's so cool. It's
but
so
it did for them, but it did. Look what it did for us.
I remember the. I remember how everything, the chronology of it, and it was. It was. Yeah. It was credited as the song, and you guys were credited as the band that helped bring Aerosmith back.
Exactly, and well, and gave birth to Kid Rock. Said Run DMC and Aerosmith had a baby, and I popped out. Yeah. Travis Barker, Blink 182, Limp Bizkit. Korn, all of those bands is because of what that union did.
Well,
so.
And you guys, you also, you bridged a cultural gap.
Exactly.
As well,
exactly.
Which was huge. Exactly. And
the metal kids knew they could we can listen to rap.
Yeah.
And then the rap kids, we can listen to metal.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
It was a black and white thing.
It was.
John Small, the director of the actual video, the Walk This Way video, people say, yo, D, when Steven takes that mic stand and knock down that wall that separates y'all, they say that didn't just happen in a video. That was prophetic. It really happened in the world. Yeah, and that's a deep thing, man.
Yeah,
so I'm proud to be part of that.
I have
I was just pretending to be the king of rock. King of rock. I was just joking. And it came true. But that's why I tell all the little kids.
My goodness.
The power of life and death and all of that is on the tongue.
One question I want to ask you going back, and because that was a fantastic story. But again, you mentioned Sarah McLachlan saving your life with a song. Did you ever get to tell her what that song meant to you and what it did for you?
Yeah, I got a morph story. You know what the morph is? The morph. There's go to morph.com.
Okay.
It's a storytelling club. It's huge.
M-O-R-P-H? Morph?
No, morph. M-O-T-H. Oh,
morph. Okay.
But I told a story. I'm listening to Sarah McLachlan's record for one whole year. That's all I wanted to do. My manager, Eric, is over there in the other room. I wouldn't go nowhere. I wouldn't make Run and Jay ride and listen to Sarah McLachlan songs. But at the end of that year, I go to my manager. That their thing was, keep Daryl busy so he don't kill himself.
Yeah.
So my manager, Eric, he's right over there. He gets two tickets to go to Clive Davis' Grammy party. He comes to me and he says, y'all got two tickets to Clive. I'm like, F Clive Davis, F music, this and that. All I want to do is sit here and listen to Sarah McLachlan. And he goes like this to me. He looks at me with the two tickets. And the only reason I went is because of this. He said, I worked real hard to get this ticket. So in my mind, I said, this fool done sold his soul to the devil to go to Clive Davis' stupid-ass party. So set change. We get to Clive Davis' party, and my manager's funny. He says, D, because I stopped wearing a hat and the glasses because I don't want to be Run DMC without Jay. You know what I'm saying? A lot. Mm-hmm. So he says, D, wear your hat. Please wear your hat for me. Why? Because if I wear the hat, it's packed at the club. If a bouncer see it, and it happened, he saw me way in the back. Everybody move to the left right now. They parted the Red Sea, and I walked in. Me and Eric walked right in the club Davis party. So we get in there, and my manager's like, yo, D, people love you, man. I know you're going through something, but, you know, just go do Access Hollywood. Go do the red carpet. Nope. I said, I'm sitting. It only came because of you, and I'm sitting here for 1 hour. And I'm going back to my hotel room to listen to my Sarah McLachlan tricks. So he's trying to do the management thing, and I start the countdown, 59, 58, 57. So he walks away. And I'm sitting there, going back to my room to listen to Sarah McLachlan. And Stevie Wonder walks in. I have a book out, too, called 10 Ways Not to Commit Suicide.
Yes, yeah.
All of this is in the book. So Stevie Wonder walks in, but he doesn't see me.
That we might buy me.
His boy sees me and he beelines. He turns Stevie. DMC's over here because the guy wanted to say hi to me. So Stevie comes over to me and you got to read the book. So then Stevie leaves. And then the last person I want to see, Busta Rhymes.
Yeah.
He sees me. Ladies and gentlemen, announcement. DMC, the king of rock. Now, these guys didn't just change music. They changed fashion. He's going to. In my head, I'm like, just get the hell away from dissonant buses. So he walks away. Jeez. And then Alicia Keys coming. Hey, DMC, how you doing? You know, I always see Run and Russell. I never see you. I didn't say I was because I'm depressed and alone and about to kill myself. So she walks away. Guess who walks in the next minute?
Sarah.
Sarah McLachlan walks in. And I go, oh, shoot, that's the lady who made it. Like I knew of her, but I didn't know her. Get it together, D. I'm trying to figure. Get it together. Walk over to her and tell her what her record did for me. So I got my confidence up. As I'm coming to her, I got to Hannah, so she sees me coming. When I get to her, she goes, it's tricky to rock around, that's right on top. Walk this way, my Adidas. And everybody always hits the B-boy. She was like, yo, Run DMC, Daryl, you know, I love you guys. You guys are great. And in my mind, I'm trying to keep myself alive. here's another good reason why, D, you shouldn't want to kill yourself. Even Sarah McLachlan likes your music. So I just say, Miss McLachlan, I just want to tell you something. The name of the record is Angel. You sound like an angel. People say you're an angel, but you're not an angel to me. You're God. And I just went on. I listen to your record every day, this and that, boom, 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 boom.
And you let it all
so
out?
So I finish, yeah, and she looks at me. And she probably was thinking, no, I just wanted to say hi to them. she looks at me and she says, thank you for telling me that, Daryl. That's what music is supposed to do. Shakes my hand and walks away. 3 years go by. I find out that I'm adopted. Then I get this idea. Oh, I'm going to make a record that's going to talk to all the kids in my situation. And I'm going to get that lady that's going to make the that her record did to me. So 3 years later, I got to record with Sarah McLachlan.
Wow.
Yeah, we did a song called Just Like Me. And I put my story over a Harry Chapin remake of Cats in the Cradle, which is a song about a father who had no time for the child. But when I was a little kid, that was one of my favorite songs ever. So, see, all of this started making sense. So I called Sarah McLachlan up, and I was like, yo, Miss McLachlan, I want to, if you thought I was crazy 3 years ago, you're going to really think I'm crazy now. I just found out that I was adopted, and I want to make this record that's going to touch people the way your song touched me, and I want to do a remake of Harry Chapin's records. Will you do it? And she goes, yes. And I go, oh, that's easy.
Yeah.
Because usually it's talk to the manager, and the manager's got to talk to the label. But then I say, okay, I'm going to bring you to New York. She says, no, Daryl, you could come to my house in Vancouver.
Cool.
So
that's so cool.
Long story short, I fly to Vancouver. We make the record. Now, remember, I heard a record. I listened to it for 1 year. I go to a party I didn't want to go to. I get to meet her. That's what music is supposed to do. 3 years go by. I find out that I'm adopted. Now I'm in Vancouver making a record with her. Before I left the session, we all getting ready to leave. She said, Daryl, wait, there's something I need to tell you. And I go, what? She goes, I was adopted too, and I did not know that.
Ah, same thing.
So what the vibe of her record was the because it's all about feelings. And I tell kids, I tell adults, anybody going through something, if you don't admit how you feel, whether good or bad, you never heal. Once you release that, you can deal with the things that you're going through. The thing that I represent is not fortune and fame and not celebrity, and that's what I want to represent at this event. I represent what happens when you give a child, regardless of their situation, every opportunity to become the people that they were put here to be, regardless of what they're going through. We all going to go through things. And the thing with depression and anxiety and all the mental health issues is this. They look at us like there's something wrong. Mental health is no different from the feeling. Like if you tell me I'm cold, I don't look at you and say, you don't be cold. Yeah. You shouldn't be cold. But when I was telling my friends, yo, I want to commit suicide. They say, D, you shouldn't want to commit suicide because, oh, you're DMC. None of that matters. Now, I feel like I want to commit suicide. So the same way if you told me you was cold and I would turn the heat up or give you a coat. We got to turn the heat up and give these people a coat. If it's hot in here, I'm going to turn the AC on. I can't tell you, Kathy, if you go, man, I'm hungry. Don't be hungry, Kathy. It's all a feeling. And sometimes those feelings are not, I feel like $1 million. Since this world has been in existence, it's nothing wrong with a person saying, I don't want to live no more. What's wrong is how we all been reacting to that. We shun that person. Run Jay and everybody in my crew said, D, suck it up, this and that. They pushed me away. So what did I do? I isolated myself. I would ask my manager when we were going to, what hotel you running, Jay? This is before Jay got shot and killed. That was another thing that I had to deal with. I found out that I was adopted. I'm a depressed, suicidal, alcoholic guy. And then Jam Master Jay gets killed. So I had to go to therapy. But I would isolate myself. What hotel y'all in? We at the Marriott. I find a different hotel. But when I was doing that, that made me sit all alone thinking I'm the only one that was going through that. But it wasn't until that I got help. I realized it's just a feeling. I can deal with those feelings.
You raise a whole bunch of great points. So we talk to you for hours and hours. But to that point about that, is that, you know, the everyone wants to do the quick fix. Well, as you said, don't think that way.
Right, you can't.
When what the person really needs is the support and the commitment.
Yes. When a person goes into therapy, the people waiting for that person to come out need to therapy too. Because now I come out a new being, people around me, they can't deal with me.
Yeah.
I'm not a different person. I'm the person that I was before all of the nonsense went down. Here's a funny joke. When I went into therapy, like you was talking about the black thing, the black masculine cool thing. When I went into therapy, I'm sitting there with the first day of my therapy. I'm 35, so my therapist probably was 46-year-old white guy. Typical doctor guy with the, you know, clipboard and a pen and a glass.
Looks like Freud.
Yeah. The first thing he asked me was, Daryl, during your whole career with Run DMC that Run J or Russell or anybody in the music in the music business do anything to make you mad? So I'm thinking, never. So he looked at me, he took it, he put his pad down, he put the pen down, he took his glasses off, and he looked me in the eye and said, "You're a goddamn Emma effing liar."
Wow.
And that hit my soul, and guess what happened? Yeah, man, in 1984, when and then in 85, it all poured out. Yeah. I was using the alcohol, like there was a lot of records, my fans think this is hilarious, there's a lot of records that we made that I didn't agree with, but I just made to make Run and Jay happy. The thing is like this. The most important thing that the most important person on earth, this is the only time we should be selfish, not with money, food, and material things. The most important person's feelings on earth is your feelings first. If you don't take care of you, your physical, emotional, and mental, and your relationships.
That's the thing. I say that all the time. Yeah, it's not selfish. If you're a happier you, the people around you are happier.
Everything falls in place. Yes. And that's what I'm here to represent tonight with the 76ers.
Yeah.
I got a question for you and check with your manager because we got to take a break. But I want to talk to you some more. But do you guys have to, you got to get out of here right now? Or
they got to go.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. I'll come back.
You got to come back.
Because, I mean, you brought us some records.
I'll come back up.
I just got a turntable and we got Back from the Dead. The Legend Lives.
You know what? I'll come back when I get back from South by Southwest, and then we could talk music and
all of this is in those songs now.
Yeah,
we've been loving this
because you've collaborated with a bunch of cool people.
Yeah, Miles Kennedy, produced by John Moyer from Disturbed. Rome from Sublime. I got Sammy Hagar and the immortal Joan Jett on this record.
You are the king of rock.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, it's coming true now.
Yeah.
Kids, dreams do come true. I'm fulfilling my rock and roll fantasy, like the record says.
And you guys aren't in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame yet.
Yes.
Yes, they are.
2009. Everybody said we get in. The only thing that wasn't real on our records was sample drums.
Right.
Guitars were live.
It was all
so
live.
Everybody screamed at Gene Simmons about Run D. Now, Gene Simmons had a point.
Gene Simmons had an issue.
He
with
had a point.
And I think, honestly, a lot of us were wondering, well, is this going to be rock or is this going to be hip-hop? And there was a blurred line.
Right.
But now...
all of Run DMC's hits are rock songs.
Yeah, yeah.
Tricky is a rock song.
Yeah,
it's
absolutely.
My Sharona. Mary Mary's the Beatles.
Yep.
And Rockbox. Completely original produced and King of Rock.
Yeah.
We made rock records. That's what made Run DMC crossover.
It's true.
You know what I'm saying? We didn't make funk and rap records that crossover. We made rock songs that brought everything together. So we got a pass going in.
Yeah, yeah, very cool.
All right, then you got to promise that you got to come back and talk
I'm
going to
come back,
again.
Yes, definitely. Right. We could talk about the music. Thank you for having me,
of
man.
Of course, man. You're a fascinating individual. So great to have you here. And the feedback on our text message board is through the You've really spoke directly to the core of some people that are saying they needed to hear.
Yeah,
what
we
you
are
had
all the same, man. And don't be ashamed if you're going through anything.
You're fantastic, Daryl. Thanks
Thank
for being
you
here,
Daryl
DMC McDaniels, guys. We're gonna take a break and we'll be right back. Stay with us.
Now more with Preston and Steve on 93.3 WMMR.
I saw this this study. It was interesting yesterday. Of course, people can now buy marijuana for medical use in 29 states and the Columbia.
And it's increasing.
And 8 states have legalized marijuana for recreational use. So there was a study that was done to find out which professions smoke the most pot. I thought was kind of, I wonder who the biggest potheads are out there.
Well,
so you guys were to guess.
Yeah. You just saying it now makes me, and no one... Besides entertainment and stuff, obvious things, I would think, no one occupation immediately comes to mind.
Like, well,
server?
You say server?
Let me.
You guys.
I think it's like something that's got to be relaxed. Like the whole
on the job or.
After,
no, not
so
on the job.
Just in general.
Just that are pot smokers.
Okay, that are okay.
But
so
like, musicians are not part of this, right?
Sure they are.
Okay, musicians.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm going to say artists.
All right.
I'll go with that. Artists, entertainment.
Accommodation and food services industry.
Wow.
Nick is correct.
Wow.
30% of workers reported smoking pot at least once in the past month. And those in the job category, food preparation and serving, had the highest use of 32% of workers.
How many smoke on the job? Like they'll go up and offer a toke to the people at the table.
Now that, probably not that many.
I actually had a friend of mine who got arrested while working.
He was smoking pot?
He was a server, he went out to the back alleyway to smoke a bowl for a quick second and got arrested.
Oh my God.
While he had, like, I don't know, 8 tables or something like that. Could you imagine going, like, where's my server? And he's in jail.
I had a similar situation, but not me. I was driving with my agent, my comedy agent.
Yeah.
I might have told this story. So he smoked pot all the time, and it was the summer, and we're driving along, and we passed by cops, I guess, and they could smell the residual, and so they pull us over. And they start going through his basket. They look through his bag, and they see these white strips, Preston, that kind of look like LSD.
Yeah.
And so he goes, "What's this?" And he goes, oh, and my agent wore a wig. Those were adhesive strips to his wig. So he tears his wig off his scalp and goes... tears his hair right off in front of the cop.
God.
And goes, "It's from my wig." And the guy started laughing. The cop started laughing so much, he goes, "Get out of here."
I'm getting a lot of text here. Some people are saying landscapers.
Yeah.
Painters.
Is it more a case, Preston, would you say that people who have more or idle time or need to decompress, people in high stress jobs? Because these are... Or people who just, I don't know. I'm looking for a hard and fast rule here, and I'm not getting it.
I'm thinking more along of where it doesn't take a lot of cognitive ability to do your job. Now, that doesn't mean that you're not thinking while you're serving, while you're waiting tables.
Right, you're working.
But you've done it so much that it's fairly routine in the steps that you take and you go through, whereas you have... like an IT person or somebody who is working, you know, as a lawyer or that has to create strategies and things like that.
I understand what you're saying.
The course of the day, they're not going to be smoking a lot of weed.
The work level can and is often very very demanding. But you're saying
that's a guess.
It's something that you can do while if you were a little stoned.
Yeah, I think landscapers kind of would do it out of boredom. You know, like it is the same routine. It may be different lawns every day or different gardens or whatever, but it probably helps to pass the time.
But then again, we're thinking of smoking pot while you're working. This is just in general.
Right.
This is,
people, this is
recreational
people,
pot smokers.
I think so. Well, but it might hold true to the same thing. Well, no.
Or somehow or another, people that gravitate towards smoking pot gravitate towards serving tables, you know?
I want to get you food.
Yeah.
I couldn't smoke before.
That's what I'm about.
I couldn't do it before because I was a server and I couldn't do it. I couldn't smoke and then be around people where I needed to, like, talk and stuff like that. But that's
would there be an issue, though, if you get the munchies and you're eating their fries? You're going to like these.
Yeah. Chicken and McNuggets are delicious, man. Casey, to that point, I've kind of gotten into rock climbing over the last year and a half. And there are a lot of people who are in that culture who love smoking pot while doing that. And
Outdoors people, trail guides.
But outdoor activities that require... paying attention to what you're doing, like handholds and footholds and things like that, and they love getting high. And I'm like, I have to focus on what I'm doing at that time. Like, to me,
it was completely
separate.
It was like anything hand-eye coordination,
exactly.
Bring it on. No, bring it on.
Oh, bring on the pot.
Anything that involved verbal, like, I couldn't even smoke and then go to Rita's and order a water ice without messing that up.
A water ice, please.
But... you know, go out and play frisbee for 3 hours,
then you were fine.
Yeah, totally.
So then you could.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
it's a great text game. It says, "Anyone twirling a sign?"
What is that?
You know, those spinning signs that people stand out in front of a store and 5 hours spinning the sign around. Hang on, let me go to some calls. I have Adam. Hey, Adam. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Gadzooks.
Gadzooks, buddy. What's up, man?
Hey, so not that I know from experience, but, you know, I'm thinking, like, the number one profession of recreational cannabis users would probably be sales.
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 Right, and why? What's your reasoning behind that?
You know, I mean, there's, depending on the type of role that you have, let's just say you're, like, an inside salesperson, you know, a lot of your day-to-day is more, you know, administrative data entry, you know, cold calling, that type of thing. You know, that's something that definitely helps, at least stay focused and pass the time.
Stay focused.
Okay, so we're talking about on the job. I think if you're out, I think there's the potential that if you're out on the road and you're You know, you're going to different calls and you have to, you know, have an appointment that gives you like a half hour, 45 minutes that you could pull over somewhere and light up.
I'm going to go to Jordan. Hi, Jordan. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. How are you?
Good. What's up, man?
Hey, I used to be a roofer and I'd be like 18 stories in the air and there'd be guys up there with like joints in their mouth while hanging off the edge.
Well, you know what? That was a question in this study as well. What about people in high risk jobs?
Right.
A roofer would be a high risk job. I mean, there's a potential for injury there. No questions. But these guys were always smoking up.
Oh, my God. I had like 9 guys on my crew and every single one of them would be high hanging off the edge. I'm like, how are you guys doing this? I mean, I couldn't do it.
Jordan, did they? Because Casey just indicated that he felt there was a better eye hand coordination during those times. Did any of your coworkers say that's the case or no?
I don't know. I never did it, but I'm gonna have to disagree. I think I was freaking out.
I think so. Yeah.
All right. Thanks, man. Yeah, it says, while the study doesn't reveal if anyone actually got high on the job, the researchers did take a special look at industries and safety-sensitive occupations in which workers are responsible for their own safety or the safety of others. Those in construction, manufacturing, and agricultural industries all fell above the state average in percentage of workers reporting marijuana use. Notably, healthcare, utilities, or mining, oil, and gas all had less than 10% of their workers report marijuana use. All three of these low-use industries are also those known to perform drug testing on employees as well.
Yes, yeah.
I've never worked anywhere with a threat of a drug test.
Drug test.
You
yes.
guys?
No,
you've never been drug tested for any job?
Yeah, here they test you to make sure that you have been smoking.
Yeah, I was going to say, dude.
No.
If they did that in our industry,
I know.
There would be no industry.
Yeah.
You know? But no, I've never worked a job where random drug testing or anything like that was ever part of the requirement or part of the employee handbook or anything along
those. Years ago at WDRE in New York, which is like my second station, they started to institute it with the higher-ups in the sales department.
Yeah.
And the talk was it was going to go through the air staff and blah, 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 blah. And I think they all sort of came to the same conclusion you just did.
Yeah.
That they're not going to have an air staff.
Yeah. Sorry. There's going to be no jocks. Let me go to this anonymous call. We have a few callers on the line who wants to talk about a high school principal. Hi, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, what's up, bud?
Not too much. Yeah, I've got a buddy. He was a high school principal.
Yep.
And he will smoke 2 or 3 times a week and on the weekends as well.
Did he indicate if other staff members, if a lot of the teachers party?
No.
Okay.
Because that's what you assume is going on in the teacher's lounge, right?
Maybe. Yeah,
they're ripping balls.
Whoa! Yeah.
This kid is so stupid.
They have a hookah.
Yeah.
Or he can just come and just grab a tube and start puffing away. All right, and then who else were you going to say?
The wife used to strip, and she would always smoke a bowl before she went on stage.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
And that would help?
That would make things more fluid. Would it improve her dancing?
Yes, it would.
Yes, it would.
So that do you have a pole at home? Does she ever throw on the old pasties for you?
Yes, we got a pole downstairs in the basement, and the friends always ask, but she always says no.
Interesting. Well, all right, thanks, man. Appreciate the call.
It'd be hard to broker that deal. Honey, do it. The neighbors are here.
Come on,
give him a lap dance.
Yeah, let me go to Robbie, who is a lab technician, sees a lot of drug tests. Hey, Robbie, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Gadzooks.
Hey, how are you? Good to see you, Gadzooks, buddy. All right, so you see a lot of people come in for drug testing.
Yeah, I mean, like, so, I mean, it's a pre-rec thing, so if you want a lot of labs, if you want to work at them, you have to get a preliminary drug test, so that happens. I was actually, I was clean for months and months and months before I got my job after I graduated, and then they told me they were going to drug test me, and then literally just never talked about it, so I stopped for that long, and never actually had to take the drug test, but there definitely are people that come in for drug tests, or they get sent out for sampling, so they do urinalysis at my work. They also do something called sperm binding, and I found out yesterday.
What is that?
All the sperm that urinalysis. It's like
Now you said sperm binding or something like that.
They also do, I just found this out as a side note, that we do sperm binding at my work, and all the sperm that they use for testing is in-house. And
what, do you handcuff two sperm together? What is sperm binding?
They use, it's like a technology that they use for, it's called reproductive technology. They use it to help people that have fertility problems.
So. Okay.
Yeah, they get sperm, and they basically test how well it could bind to the egg, basically. So
Stone sperm can't even find the egg.
Yeah, yeah.
Look, I'm looking for an egg. It's like all around.
Right.
No, I have you. So in two questions for you. Do you think that in states where they are now allowing recreational pot smoking, do you think that the weight or the gravitas of the drug testing is going to shift? Is it going to, if more and more people might be doing it recreationally?
Yeah, I definitely think so. Obviously, of course, if you have a medical card, but yeah, if once it's recreationalized, I think if you don't, I think if you have a government job, you'll probably still get tested because right. It's obviously still federally, you know, on Schedule One. But
yes, yeah.
But yeah, in terms of, I think it'll take some time. But I think, you know,
what lab do you work in?
I know you're relaxed at your job, but
all right, thanks, Rob.
You can't drop the F-bomb at ours.
I was curious about that very thing. If you do have a state where it is 100% legal, what about the policies of companies about
what
drug
does drug testing mean? Yeah. But he's right though on a federally.
Well, you got to think like the Denver Broncos or the Colorado Rockies or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, it's recreationally legal there, but the company says no.
Yeah, right. And the company will be able to set its own guidelines.
Yeah. All right, I'm going to go to Anthony. Wants to comment about the fact that the 30% of workers in the accommodation and food services report smoking pot. I'm going to go, Anthony, how you doing, man?
Good. How you guys doing?
Doing very well. What'd you want to comment on?
So you said it was 31% in the culinary industry admitted to smoking?
Yeah.
Yeah, the other 69% are lying. So I worked briefly at a 5-star catering company in Philly, and my first day on the job, we were on the way back to the shop. My first day, a guy I just met busted out a joint on the ride home. And then when we got back to the shop, they already had another circle going. I was like, holy cow, these guys are insane.
Anthony, I would have to add validation to what you're saying, because my wife for years worked in like the old, you know, families go to a place for Thanksgiving. It's like a catering hall. It was on Long Island, New York. And there was the case in the kitchen, and everyone was a pothead. Everyone. And so she would see it all the time.
Yeah, I believe it. All right.
Oh, yeah.
Thanks, Anthony. Appreciate it, man.
I mean, and the demeanor of this place, Preston, was like a courier and I have to be home for the holidays. And in the back, and you know, out in the parking lot, they were smoking their brains out. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So to Casey's point, if the company says no, then it's illegal for the employees to do so, or not illegal, but you could get fired for it. What's the policy when it comes to recreational for teachers? Like in school districts, if you're in California or Colorado.
It's got to be a teachers union issue there, right?
You think so?
Or
is it a state issue?
It'd be a...
Both?
It'd be a both. I mean...
Wait, but what
I'm pre-med, so I don't know.
So my question, Kathy, is if you're a high school teacher in Colorado, can you smoke pot?
Well, if the schools are testing and saying no, then no. If you want to keep your job.
Do you know that? That's what I'm asking.
Oh, if they do, yeah. I don't know.
And then what if, all right, it's not even recreational. What if you're a teacher and you have MS?
Yeah. What if it is medical? I don't know. I don't care.
I don't live there.
I mean, there are places that don't allow, like, isn't UPenn like a tobacco-free? Like
campus?
You're not allowed. Yeah, you're not. Are you not allowed to be a smoker?
Be a smoker and go to school there?
No. I meant like.
I think they're like one of the companies.
The health system.
So I believe Prudential used to do it as well. They would actually actively help you quit smoking. So they would put you on whatever that Casey.
Wellbutrin or Chantix.
Yeah.
Narcan.
Right. Narcan.
No. But yeah, like they would actively, I don't think you could get fired if you were a smoker, but they would encourage you to stop smoking.
And you're not allowed, there are certain places that don't allow you to smoke on campus.
Yeah.
Right, absolutely. If you want to know the other professions beside the accommodation and food services, these came in second place: arts, design, entertainment,
there you go.
Sports, and media.
Sports. Yeah, yeah.
Yes, sports.
Huh.
Yeah.
I'm
not surprised. Yeah. I'm just surprised that it was admitted to.
I think,
and you'll be surprised, the number one sport. Curling.
I think the NBA for a while, I don't know if they do now, but they used to not test for that at
okay.
all.
Yeah.
Yeah. Marijuana use was reported by 19 to 21% of workers in production, life, physical, and social science, sales and related, and installation, maintenance, and repair. So they were third place.
Okay.
How about in the world of neurosurgery?
That it does not speak to, but I have seen a lot of texts come up.
Are you kidding?
Doctors, big time.
Sorry, man.
Yeah.
Your left leg is not in the game anymore.
Interesting. Okay. I just, I never stopped to think about what particular profession might be the biggest in the world of smoking pot.
Because, yeah, well,
it's becoming more and more accessible and legal these days.
It's changing.
Pennsylvania.
Yes.
You know, medical marijuana.
Just medical. They're trying to get recreational.
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much for your phone calls. I appreciate it. We're going to take a break. So we'll be right back.
MMR's Day Off on the Slopes at Jack Frost Mountain is Friday, January 4th. Celebrate winter with the best lift ticket deal out there, along with the Pierre Robert live broadcast and a legendary happy hour with Jackson, live from the E2000 Lounge. MMR VIPs, you still have time to save money. Lift tickets are now just $20, but available only until supplies last or until noon on January 2nd. WMMR.com has the details. MMR's Day Off on the Slopes. Sip, ski, and be merry. Friday, January 4th at Jack Frost Mountain from JFBB, where the snow comes first, and 93.3 WMMR, everything that rocks.
We're happy to have the next couple of guys here in our studio because they did a great performance with Pierre at a Pierre's Presents event in 2017 at the Ardmore Music Hall. We had mentioned that we were going to have the band in today, and Pierre said, you'll never fit them all in the studio. But we have two of the band members. There's eight altogether, I believe. But we want to welcome from the Revivalists, we have Dave and Zach, who are here. Morning, gents. Thanks for coming in. Did I get that right? Eight members altogether?
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Is that a good thing? We having eight guys in a band? Sometimes.
I think for the most part, it's amazing because you know it's like somebody starts falling down, you got another guy to pick up the slack.
There
and
you
keep
go,
rolling with it, you know. Yeah. So it's good,
and it's the sound you deliver. You're delivering a fuller sound. You need that.
Yeah.
So
we got a horn section. We got two drummers, pedal steel guitar. We don't need all that stuff, but we like it. You know?
Yeah, right. And listen, it also includes if there's a bathroom issue in the middle of a show, somebody can pick up.
That has happened to me before.
I started speeding. You know, it's a kind of an acoustic ballad that we were doing one time, I'm playing guitar and Dave is singing, and I'm like, oh my god, I really gotta go. I start speeding up at the end of the song, you know, finish it real as quickly as possible and run off stage.
I always thought that'd be a cool, like a large band we used to see, like Earth, Wind, and Fire on stage. Yeah, there's all this stuff going on. I just think the energy mounts exponentially, especially with the kind of music you guys play that has an infectious element to it. And there's a fraternal thing going on there, I assume, as well.
There is, definitely.
We like a fraternity. We haze each other also.
Do you? Yeah. What is the most obscene level of hazing?
Elephant walking. What? You know? No, I'm just kidding.
I don't even know what that is.
Oh, well, it's a trunk tree.
Okay.
Yeah,
all right.
You've seen elephants. It's a stunt show, you know what I mean? We don't
Google
need that.
It after the interview.
Human centipede, you do that?
Yeah, exactly.
No, I listen.
Heavy in the morning.
It's got to be great, especially you know, having fun with each other when you guys are on the road. When you're all piled into a bus or something like that, or a couple of them probably.
Yeah.
And you got to have some fun while you're traveling around.
We have fun and we're friends in real life too. We don't just play it on TV, you know. So
that's cool.
Well, so you guys were the first ones, right? You met somebody was riding a bike. When I first read the sentence, I thought you guys were like childhood friends, right? Because I'm like, oh, who was it? Zach was riding his
bike. He's riding his little tricycle down the road.
I was 20, you know.
But no, you were a full-grown adult, and you were riding your bike, and you came across Dave, and he was playing his guitar, and so what happened next?
I mean, he was playing his guitar, and he was singing, and like he was like really like putting it out there, like belting.
Where was he?
In New Orleans. We were in New Orleans.
On the street?
On his front porch.
Okay.
On the front porch.
Yeah, in a quiet neighborhood. And I was just like, this guy sounds great. And this is cool. Like, nobody's around. He's just killing it. So I stopped and listened, and, you know, we struck up a conversation, and that's what led to us playing with each other and this band.
That's like the greatest story ever, really.
Well, it's happenstance but there was something behind it. You talk about the odds. You could have gone down another street and ended up in the Spice Girls. So there you go.
You know. Well, there's a lot
might
of
not
things
have been the worst
like
thing.
That, you know what I mean?
Yeah. No, that's very cool. So as adding members to the band, or as the band grew, was that a product of what you were composing? We need a this player, or we needed that player, or that just people come your way and you said we can add and then expand that way.
You know, honestly, it happened as organically as it could possibly happen.
Really?
It was like Zach was in a class with Rob.
Who's our saxophone player. It was a lot of like, we know this guy, he's good, let's have him sit in, it's New Orleans, you know, and they added an exciting element to the live show. And we kind of all brought our friends together and we all got along. It was like, let's keep this guy around, this is going well.
Yeah.
It sounds, you know, like Dave Matthews Band, they've got an eclectic mix of instruments with violin and saxophone. And when the band was first starting, I had an interview, I'm like, and so why'd you decide to add this? He's like, we just kind of jammed together and it just kind of fell into place. And we're like, yeah, this is all right. Let's stick with that. You know, so sometimes it's very organic. And that's when you a lot of times get the best stuff, which is really cool. Nice.
I think so.
By the way, I want to mention this. So I'm wearing this shirt this morning. And when I came in, Casey goes, you wore that on purpose, didn't you? And I'm like, what are you talking about? It's for Brandywine Branch Distillery. And on the back, you see here, it says... Revivalist Gin.
Wow.
And Casey goes, you wore that on purpose, right? And I go, no, I didn't. Why? He's like, because the Revivalists are coming in today. I'm like,
wow.
So we have mentioned that on the air today, and the guys from the distillery showed up here, and they brought a care package of some gin for you.
Oh, wow.
To take on the road with you.
You're going to love it. It's top-level stuff.
It's really good stuff. But, you know, being from New Orleans... I just want to mention that real quick. But being from New Orleans, I mean, that's a musical mecca. It's a melting pot of different styles of music.
It's a tasty gumbo, for sure.
There you go. Yeah. So what the local scene around there, is it hard to get into? Is it easy to slide right in and find gigs?
It's kind of easy. That's one of the
That's why
the
they call it the Big Easy.
That's why they call it the Big Easy. Yeah,
that is one of the reasons.
It's a great place for a young musician to move to and start working. You know,
it was actually amazing. I think it was a good place because it's not an industry town. It's an artist town. You know, so you know it's a good place for young artists to kind of incubate themselves a little bit and kind of stay out the spotlight. You know, kind of grow that presence and their confidence, and then if they want to, you know, get out there, they can do that. But also they can stay in New Orleans and be perfectly happy.
I went to Jazz Fest a few years ago, and I was struck by two things. The variety of music, which was phenomenal. You could go from one stage where Jimmy Buffett was playing to the Blind Boys of Alabama were on the other side.
Yeah.
And then the food. And you go from incredible music and incredible variety and just one great smell coming from one corner to the other. Have you guys played Jazz Fest or been a part of it in the past at all?
Oh, yeah. We've done it many times.
Yeah. It's great, isn't
Love
it?
Love that festival. Yeah. It's probably my favorite festival.
It is hot as balls, though.
Yes. Ooh,
Yeah.
Well, you know, you can always swim in the wonderfully clear water around there.
Ooh, yeah.
I'll tell you what, though, better than Ezra's, you know, they sing the praises of the New Orleans experience. There is, again, that, and there's an interesting distinction that you made. It's not an industry town, but it's a musician's musician town, it seems to be.
It is.
And that's, do you ever see yourselves, I mean, you know... Will that always be, you know, the home office there, or?
You know, for me, it is right now. It's possible that we could move. Some of us could move, but
all seven of us,
you know,
bought houses
there.
In New Orleans.
Yeah.
We all met there. We all live there. So that's always going to be, I think, the home base.
Yeah, yeah. Don't fix what's not broken, right?
Yeah.
All right, so you guys are going to get a couple of songs for us. David, I want to ask you before you play the microphone to your left there. Is that for a harmonica or?
No, it's actually a it's a really dark sounding mic.
Okay.
And I hook it up through a little thing here that kind of gives some a howl into it. It's okay. A howler.
All right, I was curious.
It's a humidifier.
Show me the effect real quick.
Wow.
Sounds like the cone guy in London.
You know, it's just...
That's got some serious sustain to it. It's got a long delay on it.
But yeah, he's got a delay pedal.
There's a reverb / delay pedal. It's called an ethereal pedal.
Okay.
How many effects pedals does an 8-person band travel?
We don't actually have too many.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, you have a moderate pedal board.
I have a healthy board, healthy pedal board.
All right.
Well, let's put these instruments to work. Let's see what are we going to hear first of all?
We're going to do All My Friends.
Excellent. All right. All My Friends. By the way, let's mention that the new album is out. That's the song that we've been playing. It is called Take Good Care by the Revivalists. And, Case, you just downloaded it.
The day it came out, I downloaded it. It's great.
Thanks, man.
Front to back.
Thank
it's you. Wonderful.
Appreciate that.
All right. So it is the latest. It is All My Friends, Revivalists on MMR.
I can't get a hold of myself. Breaking all the rules, playing games with my health. And my dove said I've gone off the rails. But I know it's okay, cause I do it so well. I'm in my 20s, living reckless. Turn the hourglass over and it's wrecked this. It's a brand new world, I got a brand new heart. And every day I get a brand new start. I'm in my 20s, not in a hurry. Got a bulletproof chest so you can hurt me. It's a brand new world, I got a brand new heart. And every day I get a brand new start. All my friends take good care of me. Wherever I go, bring me home. But I got no place to be. All give me high on my side, as far as I can see, yeah. I'm in my 20s, I'm the future, I'm a shaker, and I'm a mover, got a vision coming from afar, gonna take me back to where you are. I'm in my 20s, I'm getting restless. Got some hemp, baby, on my diamond necklace. It's a brand new world, I got that brand new heart. Every day, I get a brand new start. All my friends take good care of me. Wherever I go, they bring me home. I got no place to be. From my side, as far as I can see, yeah. Yeah. Breaking all the rules, playing games with my health. And my thug said I've gone off the rails. But I know it's okay, cause I do it so well. All my friends take good care of me. Wherever I go, bring me home. But I got no place to be. Give me high on my side, as far as I can see, yeah. Oh, my friend. Give me right to bring me home. Oh, my friend, yeah. Give me high on my side. Thank you.
Revivalists on 93.3 WMMR. We have Zach and David who are in our studio. Their new album is called Take Good Care. That song is All My Friends. And David, when you released that, did any of your buddies come to you and say, you were talking about me, right? That's, I'm one of your friends, yeah. And clearly you wrote that song about me,
yeah,
right?
There's a few.
Yeah.
A few.
You know what is it, though, about you, like, you want someday a song to be written about you. There was a rumor that there was a song written about a girl who lived in the town that I'm from, and it was, you know, a huge success, but it was, like, cool that, like, hey, she might be the girl who lives on 8th Ave, you know? Like,
oh,
you just,
yeah.
For whatever reason, it's like you want to have a song written about your life someday.
I think that would be cool.
Well, yeah. When you're looking to get
a song about me, Zach.
Well, that's got to be the move when you're a young musician starting out and you want to get laid. It's just, by the way, that's about you. Yeah. Oh my God!
All right, so let me ask you what might be a really personal song on the new record, which is called "Hate to Love You," and it's a beautiful song. I love it, but it seems like it's a painful song, and it talks about somebody that you love, but you hate to love that person. And can you share the story behind it?
I mean, you know, I think it's just at the time, you know, that was just exactly how I was feeling. You know, I was just caught between what I probably should do and the way that I felt inside, you know, so it might, without divulging too much information, honestly, like,
it was a past relationship.
Yeah,
so, okay. Like, is that person Kathy?
It's actually Kathy Lee Gifford.
Kathy Lee, I feel you, man. I have that same yearning.
It's an interesting question because, like you said, that's how you felt at the time. You wrote this song. It had an emotional connection to you. You use this as a release maybe to get those emotions out and translate them into something creative and constructive and cool. Yes. Time goes on. Your feelings have changed. Maybe you feel completely different than you did at the time when you wrote that. Can you still sing it with the same passion,
the
intensity?
Because I think the thing about it is melody and music has the ability to, it's one of the only things I feel like in smell, has the ability to bring you right back to that place.
Okay, well, then speaking of which came first, the melody or the lyrics? Or did they come at the same time? Did they
really? Came at the same time. How about that?
A lot of times they come at the same time. A lot of times it'll just be a melody, or sometimes it'll just be the words. But that particular one came, it's one of those that just kind of...
I think it's interesting, you know, artists and their different approaches to, you know, putting out their music. Like Tool, for instance, the music comes first. You know, so
and it only takes like, 10 years.
Yeah. Don't they like take acid and jam all day?
I don't know. I'm not really sure. But from what I had heard,
it's like fun.
Is that the band would compile an album, then hand it to Maynard. And
yeah, the rhythm section puts everything together first and then goes, here's the music. Write some lyrics and melodies to it.
So, yeah.
But we do that sometimes. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I think it's a very cool thing. And we've talked about it before with other artists is that you create something that will then become, in a moment in time, a song someone goes to when they encounter something in their lives. Yeah. And in a way, that is an incredible gift to know that you are sort of passively unleashing this thing that will then, someone's going to go to that, I need to listen to these guys because they understand what I'm saying. Does that ever just occur to you during the process? I mean, I don't know if it's the saying the onus is on you to do that, but it's a cool thing, I think, to have that ability to provide that for people.
Yeah, I think, well, so I don't think, it never really occurred to me.
Before. Yeah.
I think now that we get these emails and these messages of people saying these things, you know, I never got any of that before. Before it was just like a jot down in my notebook
or at a bar, go, hey man, I like that one.
Do you miss that though? A little bit? I mean,
we still have guys going, hey man.
I kind of did that when you guys first came in here this morning. But I do. Like, I really appreciate your sound, and I love all types of music, and you guys have a particular sound that just for some reason totally vibes with me, and I love it, and I appreciate what you guys do. I wanted to ask you, as a collaborative effort, how hard that is sometimes when you guys are producing a piece of art, if perhaps you don't like or you don't think a particular sound jibes with that song. How well, hard is that?
You have eight people.
Sometimes.
Yeah, yeah. It's challenging, and you know, it's a uniquely collaborative art. You know, being in a band like we are, being in a democratic band, which is why we place a lot of power on the producer a lot of the time. It's kind of like our democratically
kind of get the final vote.
Yeah, you know,
a lot of times
dictator kind of thing, and also it's about valuing being a team player as well. I think, and it, yeah. It's, you know,
and trusting.
Yeah.
That's very cool because and that's a smart move to sort of, so you have your vision, but you cede the ultimate decision to the producer.
We exhaust all avenues a lot of times. Sometimes we come back to the original thought, and then sometimes we've found ourselves completely out in left field, which is okay too.
I think with anything that's on any level of art or, you know, so, say someone's editing a movie, you can tinker and digger with something and drive yourself into a
Who produced this album, by the way?
So we had three producers on this one, which was the first time we've worked with all three of these guys. We have Dave Kopp, did about half the record. He's a really great producer out of Nashville we worked with. And then we had Andrew Dawson, who works with Kanye West and Fun, he's known for. And then Dave Bassett, who L. King and Vance Joy.
Okay. I had watched the documentary. The Avett Brothers put out a documentary on their last album. And Rick Rubin produced that one, which was sort of a departure for them. But it was interesting to me to see the collaboration between and the trust. You had talked about the trust that a band that the artists have in the producer, that they are making the right decisions for you guys.
Yeah, I think it really depends on also like the producer as well. It's like kind of like I feel like I don't really know exactly the style of Rick Rubin, but I'm pretty sure he's not like the guy, you know, doing the stuff in Pro Tools.
Listening
to the song.
yeah.
He's going no. That's got to go. More of that. Bring that up. Completely just take that, take that.
Get that out of my...
Get that out of
my face. Get that out of my face. Get that out of my beard.
You have to trust them. But then there's also the guy who's like, at the computer. He's at the desk. He's like building the things. He's
oftentimes is the producer. It's just a producer can bring a wide range of talents.
Yeah.
Do you like when a producer is a musician as well?
I do, yeah. Mm-hmm. I think it's just because you trust them a little more, I feel like, just because we...
I'm always impressed when a producer can sit down at a keyboard and bang out the melody a little bit and work with the artist.
I like that.
I think it adds to... And he'll probably, or she, will bring an idea to the table that maybe you guys hadn't thought of.
Yeah. A lot of times you can kind of... Yeah, absolutely.
And who's 100%. Your producer, since we're talking about producers here?
What's up?
The three we mentioned, but also in the past, the previous two albums, we had Ben Elman, who is a saxophone player in a New Orleans band called Galactic, and he really understands that sort of band dynamic, being a band member.
Yeah.
And he really kind of let us sort of like be us in a really nice way.
And Galactic, that's a big sound as well.
Yeah.
Galactic.
Yeah.
If you want to see a cool, there's a great documentary called The Wrecking Crew about the...
I've seen it.
Yeah, oh my God.
All those studio musicians in L.A.
Mm-hmm. Well, they just great. It's amazing, isn't it? Yeah. Because you guys with a bigger sound and a lot of musicians in it, those guys were the creme de la creme.
In the California and the L.A. scene. There's a couple good... If you've never seen Standing in the Shadows of Motown, it's a wonderful documentary.
Yes, it's great.
About the Motown Detroit session musicians that played on all of those Motown hits. They're known as the Funk Brothers.
Yeah.
It's incredible. And one of the guys plays piano in a Holiday Inn in Detroit now. It's unfortunate that it was all work for hire. Yeah.
So Unsung heroes.
They don't have royalties on it.
They just got money for the job and that was it.
And then there's the Muscle Shoals one is really great, focusing on the Swampers in Alabama. And so I love all those.
It's great. Something about a rock and roll or a music documentary is just so compelling.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we're all fans of it, and I love to see how it's created. I'm going to ask you guys a question that you guys probably don't even know the answer to, but take a 3-minute song that you guys have on your album. How many hours do you think it goes into creating that three and a half minute song?
It's a wide range.
Yeah.
It could be. I mean, you're talking about the creation of the song and then to recording the song and putting it out.
Hmm. It could be anywhere from a half hour to a total of 40 days.
Wow. You know? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. It just kind of depends.
Some just come more natural. Okay.
Yeah. Well, we want to get another song from you. What do you guys want to play?
We're going to do Wish I Knew You.
Of course, that's the song we were introduced to you playing here on MMR. How long did that song go from beginning to end before that was finally finished?
Well, why don't you speak to the writing of it, David, and then I could speak to,
Fleshing out. It was a tune where the chorus and the verse, the first verse and the chorus came like all at once, probably in about, I'd say about an hour or two. And then we took it into the studio. And how long did that take?
I mean, it took a while. I mean, yeah. we grooved on it for a long time, and we did a lot of takes of it. And then I mean, my memory is also of just shedding it
in practice spaces
for a long time.
Yeah.
That's also one of the advantages, I think, of having a band where everybody's invested in it, is that you could spend 3 hours with each other and not have to worry about wasting money, just figuring out a beat or a bass part or something.
Right,
you know, and everyone's kind of figuring out their thing,
mm-hmm.
you know, and really getting it.
That's
tight.
Awesome. Yeah. The music industry has been changing, obviously, and then people doing things on their phone, producing things. But this is a real... Yeah. This is a real
thing. It's funny. It's funny. I was sitting on the porch and I had a GarageBand beat up. So I was just jamming to a GarageBand beat.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
There you go.
You know, just as like something to kind of keep time,
like a metronome
and a little better than a metronome.
Yeah.
Just to have a little more fun.
That's cool.
Well, let's get it. We got Zach and David, Revivalists, and here they are to play for you on MMR. Wish I Knew You.
She's hot like the sun, the loneliest one, is to everything beautiful. But I'll be goddamn, standing at my door, stayed up in the city till the stars lost the war. So Friday night, Holy Ghost, take me to your level, show me the one I need the most. You're running from, and they got you on the run, yeah. So Friday night, Holy Ghost, take me to your level, show me the one I need the most. I need the most. Wish I knew you when I was young. Could have got so high.
Wow.
Yeah.
Revivalist on 93.3 WMMR. It's everything that rocks. That sounded phenomenal, man.
Yeah. Especially this time in the morning.
I get so mad, though, because, like, I just want to be able to do that.
Right.
And I can't.
Right.
You know? And, like, don't tell me if I practice. That'll be it. Because, like, there are just some people out there who can't. Right, so not all men are created equal.
You know what, though?
And I am less than.
You can dance.
Yeah
I can dance. I can't dance, man. Yeah. I can't dance.
No?
No, not all really. Right.
You know what? Neither can Mariah
My
Carey.
My girlfriend makes fun of me all the time. She's like, bro, you got to get some new moves.
So if you would like a dancer for the performance, Casey's available.
Please, right, please don't take dance lessons, because that's going to mess with your whole whole thing if you're going out there and just like doing spins and stuff.
Yeah, it's terrible.
You don't need
like,
that.
Mick Jagger took dance lessons. It's like, dude, just do your chicken. Candy, just bro. do your little rooster thing, man. That was working fine. Don't be throwing out these flamenco moves and stuff, man. That ain't you.
Man, that
play
ain't
your
you.
Strengths. Yeah.
Oh, man. You guys are just kind of out promoting the album right now.
We do have a tour coming up, as you mentioned, in January. We'll be at the Met.
And Philly in January is a great time of year to be here.
Oh, you're going
to
love it.
I just love everything. The warmth of New Orleans.
Bring your galoshes.
We've been coming to this town for like 11 years, though, by the way.
So you know. The first, one of our first shows.
We used to book our own tours, and we opened up for a bluegrass open mic at Fergie's Pub. I don't know if you're familiar with that place. That was Fergie's our first time playing in Philly. Yeah.
So the Met's an upgrade.
Yeah, a little bit. Look at you now. Very cool.
Awesome. Well, we're so glad you guys could come by today, and we love this relationship that we're building with you guys and the radio station.
It's a serious relationship. We're committed. Thank you.
Write a song about it.
I got you. Write one about Kathy.
You got to do it. All right. Thank you, David and Zach from the Lynch Company.
Thank you.
New album, just to remind you, is out, and it is called Take Good Care. You will want to get that. We're going to take a quick break. We will be back in just a moment. Make sure you stay with us.
What's new?
Glad you asked.
News. The Record Company. Fozzy.
New music. More of everything that rocks.
On 93.3 WMMR.
Now, Bizarre. WMMR presents Kristen and Steve's Bizarre File.
The B-File brought to you by New Jersey Transit Police Department. The New Jersey Transit Police Department reminds you that we all need to work together to keep our transit system safe. Report suspicious activity to 1-888-TIPS-NJT or text your report to NJTPD.
This is the most Swedish story I think I've ever read.
All right.
A road in western Sweden was covered in herring on Tuesday after an accident caused by an elk. So a truck was carrying herring.
What is this?
And forced to brake to avoid hitting an elk, causing the vehicle's fishy cargo to spill all over the road.
That's one crazy-ass story.
Between 10 and 20 barrels of herring fell out onto the road, most of them breaking open and covering the ground with the traditional Swedish delicacy.
Oh, man.
They said there's herring on a 100-meter stretch on the road, and there are herring fillets in the ditch, according to Robert Olesen from the local emergency services. The road was closed while the team of six from the emergency services got to work removing the fish and clearing the road with the help of the truck driver. Elk and other wild animals cause thousands of road accidents in Sweden each year. Over 60,000 were reported last year alone.
I believe it.
Yeah, we saw reindeer and moose all over the place when we were there. Yeah. A hotel has come under fire after its new, quote, communist theme chamber features murals of Adolf Hitler and Nazi propaganda. So I don't know why it's the communist theme.
It should be the Nazi.
It should be. Video footage.
You have Chairman Mao or something, or Stalin.
Yeah, video footage takes you inside the room in the Villa Love Hotel, which is said to be extremely popular among swingers and randy groups looking for orgies.
And somewhat unaware of history.
Two giant images of Hitler stand on either side of one bed.
The most famous communist of them all.
As a massive swastika hides behind a TV. But strangely, above the bed, the communist hammer and sickle can be seen mounted on the wall. lighting up the whole room. They were enemies.
And Sweden's own Mussolini.
The resort, located near Bangkok, Thailand, has sparked outrage, particularly among the Jewish community, for its lack of historical knowledge and sensitivity.
Hey, we tried to make a theme room.
How about this? There are lots of places it's acceptable to do pull-ups, but an airplane is not one of them.
No.
American Airlines Flight 2673 from Phoenix to Boston was forced to land in Kansas City after a passenger reportedly refused to stop doing pull-ups on an overhead compartment.
What the hell?
A witness says the man, who has not been named, boarded the plane with two dogs and appeared to be drunk. After he began doing pull-ups, a flight attendant asked him to stop, and the man reportedly became verbally abusive.
I'm feeling the burn.
After being told to sit down multiple times, the man still wouldn't listen.
I'll just go do it on the wing.
The plane pilots were forced to land in Kansas City. Law enforcement officers boarded the plane and escorted the passenger off, and the flight continued on to Boston as planned. The man was not charged.
So I guess you'd be facing in towards the seats so that your legs were bent in the aisle.
Yeah. Right.
Hanging off the...
Hanging.
Somehow or another, finding something to grip onto and doing that.
And he could find no place to put his exercise bike.
By the way, do you notice a lot of these stories end with the line, the man was not charged in the incident?
Yeah.
There's the people go, they have these crazy, outrageous, drunk outbursts on plane, and they never get any real legal trouble.
I don't get that. Yeah. They'll tase you if you try to bring 4 ounces of shampoo onto a plane.
I do follow, there's an Instagram follow, it's kind of funny, it's called Passenger Shaming.
Yeah.
I mean, it's amazing what people will do and try to do on an airplane. I saw a picture yesterday of a guy who, I guess he for his son was potty training, he had the kid taking a dump in the middle of the aisle on a potty. During an active flight. Yep,
there you go. Okay.
Incredible.
One last story. Kathy saw this. We got a nice chuckle out of this. A couple of University of Utah football fans learned that their hard-earned cash, $1,060 of it, was destroyed in their shredder courtesy of their two-year-old. According to a Twitter user, he and his wife had been saving to pay up for University of Utah football tickets in cash. As they pulled out their money, the cash was mysteriously gone. That mystery was solved when they eventually found the envelope and the cash in the shredder. The Twitter community got involved with suggestions that the couple get out some tape, and another person stated that mutilated currency can be redeemed by the U.S. Bureau of Engraving and Printing. He joked that his son, tall for his age, is grounded from all fun. He also said there is a possibility the Treasury Department will recover some or all the destroyed money amid several calls for a GoFundMe page. So... Oh, my God.
Thank God it worked out that way.
I hope so, yeah. And there you go. That's what I have for you in the Bizarre File this morning. Back in a moment. Stay with us.
This 93.3 WMMR audio on demand program returns after a brief word from our sponsors.
Hey, what's up? It's Preston. Listen, I'd like to thank Jack Frost Mountain for sponsoring today's podcast. Jack Frost and Big Boulder Ski Areas are officially open for the season. And WMMR's Day Up on the Slopes with Pierre Jackson is January 4th. Tickets are available now at WMMR.com while supplies last. JFBB, where the snow comes first.
If you love paying for shipping, you're going to hate Steven Singer. Free shipping both ways, making return and exchanges easy. Visit him online at IHateStevenSinger.com or at the other corner of 8th and Walnut. Steven Singer Jewelers. One place, one price.
Hey, it's Preston. Listen, I'd like you to make it a perfectly personal new year with our friends at Hannah Stone. Make it personal. Make it about you. You spent enough time over the holidays thinking about everybody else. Let's think about it. You now. There's over 50 locations of Hannah Stone Massage and Facial Spa in Delaware, South Jersey, Philadelphia, the Lehigh Valley, and the spa services start at just $59.95. Take a look at what I'm talking about. Hannah Stone Massage and Facial Spa. Go to hannahstone.com today.
This is the Preston and Steve Show podcast.
There's this nice little montage of celebrities, a video that was on Ask Questions, and they're big celebrities, is Tom Hanks and Jessica Chastain and a few others. Who else is there?
I just saw Tom Hanks and Jessica Chastain.
Okay, there's a bunch of them. They're talking about the first kiss they've ever had. And it's fun to hear these people that these celebs talking about their first kiss and so on. And so we had a couple of clips. And I liked Jessica Chastain's. I'll go with Tom Hanks.
Yeah, go ahead. It's cute.
It's pretty
standard.
Yeah, it's standard. So here was Tom Hanks talking about the first kiss he ever had.
The first real kiss in which we were both invested of it. Where was it? Yeah. That was in a
That was in somebody special's kitchen about 3 o'clock in the morning in Oakland, California. Oh, yeah, we knew each other quite well.
Was it someone you became close to for a period of time after?
Well, a gentleman doesn't say, but yeah.
Yeah, all right. But Jessica Chastain, this is more likely of an awkward first time you ever
kissed. And many of them are.
Here we go.
Okay, this is so embarrassing. I was at a slumber party. I was like in sixth grade, okay, so I was pretty young. And the girls that were having the slumber party invited boys, and so boys showed up, and we all started playing Truth or Dare. And a guy dared me to French kiss him. And so he's approaching me, and I'm backing up and backing up, backing up. And finally, I'm like against the wall, and I just close my eyes and just stick out my tongue. And it grazed his nose like that, and like licked his face a little bit. And then he yelled, "Ooh, she tried to French kiss my nose." And ran out and told the entire slumber party. It was fairly traumatic. And the good thing is, I will say, I have figured out how to French kiss.
That's standard. One little mess up, one little slip up, and then somebody goes and says something, and the next thing you know,
it explodes before you know it. She was with the donkey in the closet, and that's how stories get built. So.
Oh, man. Do you guys have a first, the very first time? Do you have a story?
We're talking French, right? French
kissing? Not French, regular
either
kissing.
One. Either one. I think the first time that you actively went to, this is a romantic kiss.
I'll explain. I mean? Mine was actually predicated. So I'm at a birthday party for Debbie Foley, the neighbor two houses over, the Foleys. Mm-hmm. And the dad had a Super 8 camera, you know, so it's but the birthday party, we're in the backyard, and I saw the half vanilla, half chocolate cups come out, and they're going to start dispensing those. The ice cream, my favorite, the money shot of the birthday party. So he comes out with the Super 8 camera, and he goes, "Come on, kids, gather around." He goes, "So, hey, somebody give Debbie a birthday kiss." And although, you know, boys are like, "They don't want to do that." And I'm like, and I'm looking at the ice cream thing. I'm like, you know, "All right, I'll do it." So I went over and I kissed her on the lips for the dad.
No, in front of everybody?
Because I wanted the goddamn ice cream.
That's why you mentioned that so much.
Yes.
You have such a fond memory.
Of course.
Were you, how did it feel?
I remember thinking, this is ice cream nice. Level. Yeah, it was pretty good. Yeah. Everyone had a crush. Even the little boys in the neighborhood all had a crush. Yeah.
Good for you, man.
Yeah, so, but I was also, as ice cream was my motivation.
Okay. Mine happened in a treehouse.
Ooh, I like this.
At a sleepover, and we had a couple of girls there. It was just the guys that were sleeping. It was small, and basically a treehouse was, you found three trees, and you put 2x4s, and you made a big triangle, and then you put slats across those.
Yeah.
And
it was a death trap.
It was totally, God. In fact, I think one of us rolled off of that in the middle of the night and fell on the ground.
Real quick, which random supplies did you bring up into the treehouse?
Oh, I don't remember. Just junk.
Yeah.
You know, just garbage food, whatever it was.
Pillows, perhaps.
Yeah, a little champagne. Yeah. So strawberries.
So it was, there were four of us, two guys, two girls, and the girls just came to visit. They weren't staying the night. Of course, they weren't allowed to, but they snuck out or whatever, and I was probably in like fifth grade or something like that, and we played a little game called Truth or Dare.
That has been the impetus for millions of first kisses.
Absolutely. And it was so awesome. There was no tongue involved, but I really liked this girl a lot, and so we kissed on a dare thing, and it was but it was
did you do butt to mouth?
No,
I'm sorry. That's a little more advanced. I'm sorry. So, long kiss, short kiss.
It was long for the time. You know, it was more than a peck. That's for sure.
Did you get nervous?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, yes.
I was so fueled by a desire for ice cream that I was almost like an ET when he grabs her in the, classroom.
Yeah.
That's when I was like, ice cream.
Yeah.
And then when I thought better of it later, I'm like, I just kissed a girl.
And I remember being, I was so happy.
Were you?
Oh, yes.
Did you go boast? Did you go tell?
Because I'm a romantic.
Yeah,
heart.
Yeah.
And I felt like I was in love. It didn't. I know.
I found
weird.
Someone to do my term papers.
I didn't. Whatever it was pretty magical.
Did you end up having a little thing with her? A little.
No, it was fleeting. It was. It was in the moment. And that was.
Sweet mystery.
Jesus Christ, that was good.
That's the way it felt. So, you know.
And that was, that is, that's just the bread in the meal. And
oh, yeah.
You know, little did you know.
I was too young to even think about the other stuff.
Conceive. And there's a beauty and an innocence to that. But so many times that first kiss goes staggeringly awry.
Oh, it can. Did you guys have a good experience your first time,
Kathy? I was at a party.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was a bunch of kids around. And I, you know, we were going out. And, yeah, this was our first kiss. And I'm sitting on a couch and I was leaving and he kissed me goodbye. And it was, like, in front of everyone. And I was older than, you know, than, like, all of my friends had already had their first kisses. So it was, like, a big deal and everyone knew. So, like, you know, as I was walking out, everyone was like, "Whoa, she had her first kiss." You know, so it was
so he just like grabbed it like when,
yeah, because I was leaving. I was like, "Okay, I'm leaving, my ride's here, bye." And then yeah, we were just sitting, like, it was we were in a, you know, my friend's living room, parents were at the house, it wasn't like a drinking party or anything like that,
and he had to get back to his wife and kids.
No. Oh.
so how old are you?
I think I was 8th grade.
Okay. And was this French or just a
regular? Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And you didn't know it was coming?
I mean, no, I kind of did. We were, quote, going out. Like I said, you know, it was the end of the party. And
do girls, though, I think we all, to some levels, you at a certain point start ruminating on it a lot. Like,
well, I just, usually, you know, at that age.
How do you do it?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, I was, yes.
Practice?
I didn't know.
Yeah.
No, I didn't practice, but I didn't know how to do it. Like, I had no idea what I was doing.
How old were you?
I think I, because I'm thinking of who it was. And
you said you're about 8.
No, I think, 8th grade.
Oh my God.
I think it was 8th grade because I remember the kid, he was a year younger than me. So either he was 6th and I was 7th, or I was 7th, or he was 7th, I was 8th.
You guys want to hear something insanely embarrassing?
Yeah, please.
You talk about how naive you are at that age and what you think you might know and what certain terms you think they might mean.
A little knowledge is dangerous.
And they don't, you don't really know what they mean. There's a scene in Risky Business where a guy goes, "Yeah, man, he effed her." And then later, he boffed her after school. And then later on, he effed her. And Tom Cruise goes, "Dude, boffing and effing are the same thing." He's like, "What'd you think it was?" Like, "I thought it was something else." So when I, oh God, I've never told anybody. Right. I've never told anybody this in my life.
Would you prefer we not look at you?
No, it's okay. Okay. It's okay. It's just embarrassing. It wasn't anything I did. It's what I thought something
was. It's
what
was done to you.
And I remember being in, God, probably, no, it wasn't anything done to me. I was probably like 4th or 5th grade. I'd already seen porn. I'd seen, you know, magazines.
Oh.
I'd seen,
not movies.
No, just not movies. Like,
I had a monthly membership to the local porn theater.
No, back in the day, it was magazines.
Okay.
So anyway, but I thought the term screwing.
Oh.
I didn't know it meant.
Yeah.
Right.
Boffing. Yeah.
I thought, and I'll be as delicate as I can, and how I got this idea at this age, I'll never know. I thought it involved a fist and a butt.
Oh, jeez.
No, I don't.
And the movement of screwing?
Yeah.
Wow.
Your parents should have monitored you a little better.
Dude.
I never said that. I didn't even know that was possible until I got.
Maybe my warped mind created that somehow or another.
And gay porn is your calling.
Yeah, maybe you were just ahead of your time.
God, maybe I was.
Yeah.
Because now it's an industry.
Yeah.
Exactly. You were the inventor. You're the Kegel.
You really skipped this conversation ahead.
We're talking about
first kisses.
It's funny to bring it up, Preston.
Because in my head.
I told you the first time I saw, and Bill loves these conversations, the magazine at the bottom of the garbage can, the neighbor's house. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying it was their magazine. It was just at the bottom of the garbage can. And I was looking at a picture of mouth gratification going on. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you're a kid, like,
why is she doing that?
Pee-pee comes out. And I remember just going back, and I was almost like sitting on the couch at home like, what the hell was that about?
You're just absolutely.
What?
Yeah.
You cannot even wrap your mind around it.
Yeah.
So the idea of that as a...
I'm sorry to jump the hyperspace.
We just went from Mr. Rogers here, first kiss and a Valentine's card and screwing.
It's a hustler. Oh, dear God. I'm sorry.
I had a friend, the first time he had sex, he said to me
that he just got schwinged. And this was right around when...
Wayne's World.
No. I was at a friend's house, and his girlfriend at the time lived across the street. And he came out, and we both happened to be leaving to go back to our respective homes at the same time. And he came up. Yeah, it was when Wayne's World was popular.
He got schwinged.
And I had no idea what the hell he meant. I was like...
Schwing, even per Wayne's World vernacular, is a boner.
That's what I thought.
It is. Yeah, that's not an act.
So I thought he was trying to say something cute or funny or whatever, and then later on I was like, wait a minute, did you guys have sex? And he said yes, and I was just like, well, I mean, it was so beyond me.
He probably derived it from seeing it, because when they would say schwing, they would lift their crotches up like that, and maybe he saw that motion and thought that meant...
I just got church lady.
Yeah.
By the way, here's a text. There's a few coming in of people that misunderstood certain things. Here's one that says, I once accidentally asked my uncle if he was going to go flog his log because it was from Greece. You remember?
Yes.
Rizzo says that.
Flog your log.
And he says, do you know what that means? Here's another one that says...
I love that.
Hang on a second here. Where was the one on here? Vacation with Ed Helms talking to his son about what he thinks a rim job is. It's hilarious. I don't remember that.
It's great because later on, the son is sitting with the girl he sort of had a crush on throughout the whole movie in their campsite, Preston, and he asks her if she would like that.
Yeah. Okay.
I was at Great Adventure with my friend and his parents, and I didn't even know what I was doing, but I had a churro. So you know what churro is.
Yeah.
And I took it and I put it right in my crotch area, and I was like, and the parents are there, and like I was grabbing it and shaking it right in my crotch area. I was maybe 9.
So you had no sexual basis.
Oh, nope.
Let me ask you a question, because Casey, I did not have. I was the oldest, but you had older siblings. Did they teach you at all about sex?
No.
Okay.
I had a sister.
And you had at least a brother, but he didn't clue you in?
No. Wow.
Yeah, but you can make out with your sister. My older brother was, my older brother Gene is older by 9 years, so he was like out of the house when I was starting to come into the awareness period. So everything I picked up from my neighbor's garbage can.
Well, ours was all like secretive. Like we were like, do you think Jimmy had sex yet?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I remember when I was... starting to, you know, like French and had a girlfriend, stuff like
Latin.
That.
Yeah.
That, that things perhaps were going to go a certain way. And I didn't necessarily, and I'm talking below the belt, and I didn't necessarily know what to do. I asked my friends, I'm like, hey, what, you know, like when you, like, what are you supposed to do? Like, I had no clue that, oh man.
Do you know?
And I don't want to get too graphic here, but I didn't know that there were hand warmers down there. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I had no idea what was going on with the anatomy there. So I didn't know.
Well, which sort of raises a point. Like at that time, you know, right now, there's a way you would like things to progress. Most parents would, or kids or whatever, you know. But you can go online and find, you know, there are books and things and videos that are meant to help young people understand this stuff.
Yeah.
For me, it was everybody I knew learned by just finding it out on their own.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. You know, and it was so it made it. You might as well have been visiting another planet. It was such an alien concept.
Yeah, a friend of mine from high school was dating a girl, and you know. Let's talk about the word whack, right? Yeah. Like a weed whacker.
Yeah.
Well, I think she thought...
that's what you're supposed to do?
Like you're interrogating it?
Like hitting?
Yes. Smacking.
Come on. Where were you on the night of August 15th?
And these are... And that's how it is.
Uh-huh.
You sometimes misunderstand. You think you're supposed to do this thing because it has a certain name and you've interpreted it that way. And it turns out you were way off base.
All right. So, like my first time... with a condom. The girl I was with unrolled it.
As
if you were putting on a sock.
Right.
And I'm like, is that the way you do it?
That's like 40-year-old virgin.
It's like trying to put on a wetsuit. I can't. I can't get this goddamn thing on.
Get a shoe on or something.
like you're putting on a tube sock.
See, I didn't know anything. I didn't learn anything. My parents didn't tell me.
They took you out of the classes, right?
I didn't have older siblings.
You're not going to ask your brothers.
Well, but they were younger than me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But even friends, like at that point, when you're younger, like you didn't want them to know that if you did that, because then you were considered a little slutty. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
We didn't even talk about it with our girlfriends.
Sure. I wonder why you ended up the way you did.
What do you mean?
Well, what do you mean? I'm very sexual.
As a parent, you know, you're supposed to be the one that does the birds and the bees chat, right? But you're not supposed to be the one that does the technique chat.
Yeah, seriously. You know? My mom's not going to tell me how to give a...
Well, yeah, go ahead, complete that. It's right out of American Pie with Eugene Levy. He's describing, yeah. And that's how uncomfortable it could get. You know what started to serve the purpose was cable TV at that time. You would get your Emmanuels,
yes,
and your your hard R movies, yep, and your late night movies, and that was how you started to get an understanding.
Yeah, but now, like, all right, so these kids are learning via
it's a whole different story.
Tube sites and stuff like that, yep, and that crap is just straight up disrespectful.
Yeah.
Well, you know what I mean?
But it goes back a little bit. There was a Freaks and Geeks episode where one of the guys got a hold of a porn reel.
Oh, yeah.
And was watching it. And he was a virgin. He had no idea. And he's looking at stuff. And he's like, why is he doing? It can't be this way. And he went to the coach, who was Tom Wilson, I believe.
Yeah.
And he said, and of course, you would never see this day. He sat down. And he's like, look, this is how it is. Don't believe that stuff you see on TV. I've even told my son that.
Well,
I've said, look, I'm not stupid. I'm sure you guys have found this thing called the internet and what's on it.
Oh, you
and
said
I'm like, this. I'm like, it ain't that way in real life.
Right. And what do they say to you? They just kind of okay,
Dad. Yeah.
Well, it's creating a world, and you know, we've read the reports where people had this porn world expectation of intimacy that is falling far short.
Yeah. It doesn't exist.
Yeah. Well, all right, so, Press, listen, I commend you for saying that to your sons, and I just hope that anybody else is doing that for their sons for the sake of your daughter, for the sake of my daughters.
Sure. Well, my dad...
You know, have that conversation with your kids.
My dad went the extra mile, and he rented porn movies for us.
That's right.
Hey, kids, deep throat. It's going to be wild.
How old were you?
I was a teenager, so I was, I'd say I was...
In this day and age, it's a jailable offense.
Seriously, seriously.
So there was much of for Christ's sake, we were sitting there as just kids watching the Christine Jorgensen story about the first transgender opera, or the first successful one, and I'm sitting there with my popcorn and my snow caps, I'm like, that's wild. The guy started the movie as a dude.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. So how about those first kisses?
Yeah, innocent first kisses. Innocent.
I was looking up this book, and I couldn't remember the name of it, but it's called Where Did I Come From? And it's from the mid-80s, and it was quintessential for me in learning about puberty, because I did not have an older brother. My parents were shy about talking to me about it.
Did you ask your parents at all?
No, and I remember I went to away camp for 2 weeks, and my dad tried to have the chat or a chat with me about it. And it was embarrassing, you know, and it was embarrassing for him. It was embarrassing for me. And I was like, yeah, Dad, I know exactly what you're talking about, even though I had no idea what he was talking about.
Just make this end.
Right, exactly. Yeah,
Stop this.
I have to take out the trash. But this book, Where Did I Come From? I would get this for my son, because it's like, and my son is 11 now, so he's on the precipice of knowing about these things, or if he doesn't already. And it was really helpful.
Yeah, you don't want your kid learning it from another kid, but I sure as hell don't want my kid teaching another kid, right?
Yeah.
So and I'm getting towards that point now. My son was just saying to me a couple of weeks ago, and my wife was listening in another room and just laughing, because he was like, I think it's weird that, you know, like my daughter, my son's saying this to me, that Casey looks like you. And I'm like, yeah, well you know, she's part of me. He's like, yeah, but like how? I don't get it. Like, you know, she was made in mom, and I'm like, nah, but she's, you know, so he didn't understand about the seed and the
and the egg and the seed making it to the egg. And I'm like, I don't know how you could have done
what my mom
wine
used to just say.
Plus wheelbarrow equals.
No, my mom would just say, Quinn, do you want to go get ice cream?
Yeah.
Like completely divert the conversation.
See, my father had a different approach. He said, I think we can learn a lot from Harry Reams.
I told you guys this before. My mom took us to the zoo. Yeah. That's and we saw animals, and she was like, "That's how, there you go. That's how babies are
so
made." And we
on your
like,
first date, did you throw your poop?
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, she still talks about it. She's like, "Yep, took you to the zoo."
Now is where we swing on a after sex, Kathy's first time. Now we swing on a tire and throw crap at each other.
Oh, that's how babies are made. Yep. And that's why from now on you're. And I'm not even going to say it.
What do you mean?
No, I was going to say doggy style, because that's what you saw in the zoo. Yeah.
But prairie doggy style.
Prairie doggy style.
Exactly.
Meerkat style.
Wow. Okay.
Well, the innocence of the first kiss.
The innocence of the first kiss.
And screwing, which was totally misinterpreted.
Well,
you're like a Roto-Rooter employee.
I'm sorry.
To Casey's point earlier, there really are two first kisses. There's the innocent elementary school first kiss, like that's the playground one or treehouse or whatever, and then there's the first French kiss makeout session.
Yeah. I remember that one.
Yeah.
I remember, and I know we're a little bit of a time issue here, but the first time you steam up a car, that's the banner time.
Yep, it's pretty awesome. Okie dokie. We were going to talk about something else, but we talked about that, and that's what happens on the Preston and Steve Show. We're going to take a break, and B-Files on the way. Stay with us.
93.3 WMMR presents Preston and Steve's Totally Office Calendar 2019. 12 magnificent months featuring the most gorgeous girls and our loveliest listeners.
On sale now for just $15 in the MMR Rock Shop at WMMR.com. Order by December 10th to have it in time for the holidays. Or get your hands on a free copy at an upcoming calendar raid while meeting the girls and the members of the show.
Details at WMMR.com. 93.3 WMMR. Everything that rocks.
Not only is our next guest a rock legend, he's a bit of a character, too. And we are happy to have him here in the studio, ladies and gentlemen of the Grateful Dead. And with his show, Vibrational Expressionism, in our area for a few different shows, please welcome the one and only Mr. Mickey Hart.
Yay! All right.
Morning,
okay.
Mickey.
Wow, I love the way you did that.
Well, thank you. I love the way you did.
That was really great. You had rhythm. You had rhythm.
See?
Thank you.
You know, who could ask for anything more?
Let's get right into that. I love that you love rhythm so much. It's a huge part of your life.
It's everything.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not melody and it's not harmony, but it certainly is rhythm.
Okay.
Nothing against harmony or melody, but the whole universe is based on rhythm, and I just happen to play drums, which is fortunate.
Yeah, that's nice. I was talking with these guys off air. I bet you're a kindred spirit in another great drummer, Stuart Copeland, who is also to this day a proponent of rhythms and living rhythmically as well.
Exactly.
Yeah. Do you know Stuart?
Yes, I do.
Okay, I figured you guys might be buzzed because you should.
We don't know him that well.
Oh, okay, I gotcha. But you've found a way to infuse rhythm into your art, into the visual and the sonic, and bringing it all together. I was watching a video of you doing your work, and it really is unique. I don't know of anybody else doing the type of art that you're doing.
Perhaps.
Can you describe it for those who may not be familiar?
Well, it's a pouring medium where I don't use a brush, and as I pour, I vibrate the canvas or whatever surface I'm working on, and so that allows the paint to come up through it, and then you see these little sparkling rivers, and you follow them, and it's kind of a map. It's a storyboard. No beginnings, no endings.
But it's
all full of rhythm.
It's a representation of that of the sound, which is
absolutely
like a straight A B. That here's the sound, and this is the art it created.
Well said.
Boom.
Yeah. Boom.
There you go.
Do you ever use some?
It's a visualization of what goes on in my head. As it's probably not many people might not want to go inside, but that's what it looks like nevertheless.
All right, that's cool.
Do you ever use heat or torches when using this type of paint on a
torches?
Yeah.
No, I don't use torches, but I do use heat.
Okay.
Torching is a little bit Let's see, dangerous?
Yeah.
Yeah, but I do apply heat as well. That's a very good
Well, my girlfriend's an artist, and she's done this type of thing, and actually I'm not, but she introduced me to it, and it's pretty amazing what a little bit of heat can do to something that already exists. It's like it's almost like cooking.
Absolutely, if you know how to use it and you learn the language of the heat and learn the language of the paint, and that's what this is all about. So if you're about... I've been doing it for about 15, 20 years.
Wow.
And, well, it's personal. It was a personal thing. I didn't sell it. I didn't go out and put it in the galleries until recently.
I'm wondering, though, as an artist, have you ever created something that you're like, I like this too much. I don't want this to be out of my possession.
Oh, lots.
Yeah?
Yeah.
That's the big issue with me, you know, letting it go.
Right.
Each one of them, you know, it's a piece of you.
Yeah, because I'm looking at a piece. We were just watching a video in here, and I was looking at it, and I was like, if I created that, that
I wouldn't want to give that up.
I wouldn't want to give that one up.
Well, that's really a good observation, and but yeah, it's hard.
Yeah,
and it's also hard to know when to stop when you're doing this kind of work. You know, when the painting is done.
I think that would be the. An incredibly difficult step because especially the nature of the art that you're doing. But what I love is that you've explored the effect of rhythm on the brain and done some pretty intense research on it. But I mean, so when we first come into being, we're listening to a heartbeat, you know, when we first become cognizant of that, and that informs everything that happens for the rest of our lives. What have your experiments and stuff that you've done with this, what have they taught you about how essential rhythm is to being a human, of what we are?
It's a very simple thing.
Yeah.
13.8 billion years ago, the blank page of the universe exploded.
Right.
A big bang, and it created us and everything. We're made of star stuff. So it's all a rhythmic-based universe. Your heart beats, your lungs pump, your eyes blink, you walk. Everything is rhythmic. Now, if you can have a lifestyle like that, and understand the rhythmic nature of life,
right?
Then you've got to step up.
Okay.
How do you explain people that have no rhythm then?
Everybody. Hey, can you comb your hair?
Yes.
What's left of it?
No, he's got. I'm the bully.
Oh, like, how about that? Well, then you have rhythm.
Yeah.
You know, there's nobody who does not have rhythm. You might not be able to play an instrument because you have no skill.
Okay.
But you do have rhythm for sure if you're alive. If you don't have any rhythm, then you're dead.
Mickey, rhythm doesn't necessarily have to be metronomic. It doesn't have to be.
No.
Yeah, it can flow.
The rhythm of the ocean, the rhythm of the trees, the rhythm of life. I mean, no, it doesn't have to be an instrument. The instruments are a way for us to focus, the universe, to be able to, you know, mirror it and to be able to be part of it. That's why we have instruments. That's why we have music. There is no culture on this planet that does not have a music.
Right.
There's a reason for that because it's species specific and it's also species defining.
Interesting.
That defines us. You know, that's our badge of identity, our music, our art.
You were exposed to percussive instruments and rhythm early on. Your dad was well known and well respected. And
I wouldn't go that far.
He was a musician?
He was a musician.
Okay.
I wouldn't go that far.
Oh, really?
All right.
But he did dabble.
Okay.
Yeah. All right.
And then you were working in a you had a job and you were
had a job once.
A jazz club?
Once.
Yeah.
A long time ago. I can't remember. Yeah, it was the last time I had a job.
Just thinking, you don't call this
just
a
thinking
job?
Of the idea of having to have a job just gives me the willies. I mean, what would I do with the job? Oh, my God.
You wouldn't be a 9-to-5 guy working the cubicle?
No, I doubt it. But if I had to, I would.
You would.
Yeah, but I don't have to, and I won't.
Yeah.
But so you don't view what you do as a job?
Oh, no. It's a service. It's a service industry. I mean, that's what music is all about. You know, you provide a place where people can come and have an emotional moment,
right?
And ritualize. So, yeah, I know, and I think it's very profound, and I'm very honored or blessed or whatever you want to call it to happen to fall into this universe as a percussionist or a drummer. You know, to be able to do that is
But maybe even people...
The good thing.
Yes. People who are maybe in the same situation as you viewing it as a job, the fact that you don't view it as some, you know, you view it the way you do.
It's not easy, but it's not like a job. It's like when I get up in the morning, the first thing I do is think of, you know, the new day and what kind of new rhythms there are in it and how I can interpret that. And that's what musicians do. They interpret, you know, society and whatever, you know, mm-hmm. you've seen or whatever it is. And they lay down that groove. And every 5-10 years, you find a new groove, and you work at it. Yeah, you do work at it, but you work at play. You work to play.
Sure.
You know, you have to keep your skill up. I play every day 2-3 hours.
Do you?
You know, absolutely.
Yeah.
Are you kidding? Absolutely. In order to get up there and do what I do.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an athletic event.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like it's not like lounge drumming and stuff. This is the power stuff, you know. Mm-hmm.
Well, speaking of reinventing and finding new grooves, I want to ask you about John Mayer, because he's been with the band and touring with you guys for a stretch now. And I think a lot of people initially dismissed him as poppy and not the really great, incredible guitarist that he is. And from my perspective, he seems like the perfect fit for the Dead. Because he holds you guys in reverence, but he can also hold his own. What are your impressions on John?
John's a sharpshooter.
Yeah.
You know, he's a gunslinger, you know, as it were. And his guitar, he's beautiful. He plays great. He fits perfectly in the band. And he's a nice guy. I mean, I know he has this reputation and all that stuff. But I've never had a moment of weirdness with him. He's just a very pleasant person to be around, and he plays his ass off. You know?
Before he was a star, he played in the conference room down the hall in these offices. And I went to see his show that night, and one of his strings broke during the performance. He tuned the guitar to itself and kept it. He didn't miss a beat. And right then, I knew this guy had it, and I was so impressed by his ability.
I'll tell you, when I knew he had it, was one day when he was just joined the band, and I had gotten him into this droning things, feeding back, you know, getting a little crazy. And so during the drums and bass part, he got down on his knee and he put the guitar into the speaker and he started feeding back.
Mm-hmm.
And I was looking at him and I was saying, oh, okay. So I walked around to the front of the speaker, sat down right next to him, and I had what do you call it? Lighter fluid?
Yeah.
And the other hand, I had a Bic.
Okay.
And so he looked at me, I looked at him, and I said, I went like that. And for a minute, I thought he was
going to do it.
You know, and then, so he took it, he did take it while he was feeding back, and he put the lighter, or he put the Bic on his amplifier, and he took the lighter fluid and used it as a slide. And so he played slide.
He didn't go full Hendrix on it.
And I said, John, you were going to do it. And he said, you know, I was really thinking about it, but the guy who makes my guitar is in the audience. So I couldn't do it. He almost lit his guitar on fire, so I knew right then he was okay.
Wow.
I was wondering if you had watched the Grateful Dead documentary that was on Amazon and what your thoughts
were. No.
It was very, very in-depth.
Oh, God, it was just awful. I just did not like it.
You didn't really? Care for it.
It was just a one-sided affair. It was not for me, and not. It really didn't show the Grateful Dead in its totality. It was more like a Jerry, you know, whatever that is.
A
memorial
Jerry.
Thing or whatever
he
was trying to do. But it wasn't really. It didn't have the heart of the Grateful Dead.
Okay.
That's for sure.
There's been a lot done about
They made me watch. Oh. I watched it once.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
Just to say I didn't like it. But that's it. I didn't see it at the premiere. Me and Bob and Bill, we went out and had dinner while they showed the movie.
That's funny.
He came back right at the end when they all started. And we go, okay.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask you about some of the things that you do like. I was listening to the concert in Paris, 1974, this morning.
Yeah.
What was it besides the United States? What was your favorite country to play in?
Oh, Jesus. That's a good question. I think that I can't answer that question because they're all good when you play good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, every country is the same.
Yeah.
I mean, if the music is played well and we have a great time, France is great, England's great, Germany's, it's all good if we play well. If we don't play well, the city sucks.
This place,
blame the
we
city.
Blame it on the city.
Blame it on the city.
Of course. Yeah. Franklin Port.
I also, as a fan, I there's an ebb and flow to the way I listen to your music. And so recently I flowed back to, I guess I ebbed back to. I ebbed back
one
to.
Ebbs.
To studio albums. Do you, I don't know if you ever listen to your own music.
No.
But do you have a favorite studio album?
Yeah, I would have to say it would be, it was half studio and half live. It was called Anthem of the Sun. I think it was our second record. You know, back to 3,000 years ago.
Yeah.
And that was probably my favorite. American Beauty, Working Man's Dead. They were nice, fuzzy, warm.
See, my first album I ever bought was Mars Hotel, so I automatically go back to that one. And Unbroken Chain.
We were never very good in the studio. We never could cage the animal in the studio.
When did you realize that? Was it seemed to be early on.
Yeah, well, we thought we could make, you know, no one knew how to make a record. But I mean, we didn't know how to make anything. You know, we were just musicians at the time, and we weren't really savvy on studio. No one had a studio.
Right.
Now I have a studio. Everybody has a studio. So we just weren't producible. You know, there was too much anarchy in the band. Too many people wanting to do... you know, they had strong opinions of it. So, and we never really liked it in the studio, the four walls. You know, it was too captive. It was like a captive in the studio. And we never really made a great record.
Do you approve or disapprove of the phrase or the name jam band?
No, I understand what it means.
Yeah.
I mean, basically... It's jazz improvisation.
Yeah.
That's what they call a jam. That means that you improvise.
Right.
And some people improvise more and some people less. Some people just think they're improvising by playing over chord changes. You know. So jam band means a lot and it means a little.
Right.
You know,
right,
at the same time. You know. But there was we couldn't remember what we played the day before. Don't be sorry. Okay, so basically that's how we became a jam band because we just said, screw it. You know, no one gets blamed. I remember one time Bob came off the stage. He was supposed to play something, and then we were going to do something else. Make sure you do that, Bob. And then when you do that, we'll do this.
Right.
And so we came off the stage. Of course, Bob forgot. So afterwards, somebody got on him. I can't remember who it was, and then we all looked around and we said, we can't do this, because if we do this, we won't last.
Right.
So we never blamed anybody for anything, mistakes included. You know, it was just part of the show.
Yeah.
You know, it's life, and that's why we lasted so long, because we never played the blame game, and that was the big secret, you know, in the Grateful Dead. You know, if you messed up, you just move on. Just move on.
If you're just tuning in, Mickey Hart from Grateful Dead is here with us. Vibrational Expressionism is his art shows. I wanted to ask you about, you guys had a pop explosion in the late 80s when you hit with Touch of Grey and Hell in a Bucket, you know, In the Dark. Was that fun? Was that cool? Was it neat seeing a whole bunch of people who maybe had not been turning? You always had legions of loyal fans, but here all of a sudden, boom, you had fresh music. And the tour was gigantic. Was it fun?
Oh, yeah, it was fun, but it wasn't quite like that. What happened was we were already playing stadiums at the time. Mm-hmm. That was in 87.
Yeah.
So instead of playing 1 or 2 days at the stadium, we're playing 3 days at the stadium.
Yeah.
So it really didn't affect us much.
Were touring sold out shows anyway.
We didn't even feel it. We were playing stadiums.
Okay. Yeah, but you know what? I found that more incremental. About you guys. Because of Touch of Grey, there was a music video. I was young at the time, so so you guys had a music video, so you were totally reaching an audience.
Yeah, we never did the videos or anything. We never did a single, we weren't really part of the music industry. You know, we never played that game, and if we lived by the single, we would die by the single. Mm-hmm. You know, if we didn't have a hit.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
It's funny because I remember becoming aware of the Grateful Dead, you know, through the iconic artwork that was associated with the band.
Yep.
What's that about? So that predates, obviously, videos, but still,
a visual medium brought me into the awareness of the music, which is very cool.
Exactly. It mirrored the music. In the old days, how that started was these artists would come to the shows, and we were all getting high. You know, it's like active drugs, taking acid and whatever. And these were physical representations of what the music sounded like. They would go home and they would start painting, and they're still high, and that's what these things were representing. They were representing the music.
Were you vetting that, or was it just sort of, if you want to do it, or would you guys kind of consciously say, I don't like, that doesn't represent our band right, or was it just an open source?
Well, luckily in our case, the people would come up with these incredible,
iconic stuff.
Yeah. We just had to choose between the good stuff. I mean, it was so much good around. A lot of people went home and just did it. And it was uncommissioned.
Yeah.
They just went out and said, this has to be done.
Wow.
And so then all of a sudden we looked at it and we go, that's us. And they go, okay, cool.
That's cool.
That's it.
Yeah. Okay. Wow.
And it was just so very easy.
Yeah.
You know, there was so much great art springing from the music and the scene itself.
Yeah.
Remember, those days, we couldn't afford ads and papers and so forth. No, nothing on the radio, because remember, it wasn't even AFM radio then.
Right.
Yeah. And so the only way you could find the shows and know when they were, but was looking at the posters.
Yeah.
So the poster art became a huge thing.
Yes. That's what caught my eye.
Well, that was the way we would advertise these shows. And they were slightly camouflaged as well. So the straights couldn't read it. And they couldn't come.
They
wouldn't show up there, so only the heads would be there.
Well, Mickey, you'd see the press, you know, on a notebook, a kid in school.
Sure, would draw the logo.
What is that? Mm-hmm. What is that? And that began, it was actually, you guys were viral before viral. In a way.
Indeed. Yeah. Well said.
Yeah.
I wonder how much money you guys made just on college posters alone. Because, you know, like, right? Walking up and down my freshman hall, they, you know, and that was 1993. They were everywhere. And it's just,
I wouldn't say that paid the rent
okay.
or anything, but it was a revenue stream for sure. But, you know, hopefully it went to the artists. We were mostly interested in you come in, you pay to see it. See us play, and then that's what, you know, that's what, you know, that's it.
Right.
I mean, you know, there weren't even shirts
right.
back then. Yeah. There was no merch then.
Right.
I mean, Kreutzmann was selling it, the T-shirts out of his trunk of the car. We were the first ones to do that.
Yeah.
First ones to make, you know, band shirts, and it was Pigpen and so forth.
Yeah. You guys were trendsetters.
Yeah, indeed.
Well, you talked about getting high. They just legalized recreational marijuana
in
Michigan. Yeah.
I've got some for you here.
It's state by state.
It's legal. It's definitely.
It's legal in this studio. I don't know if you know
it's legal
that.
In this studio.
Yeah, we voted too. What are your thoughts on legalization state by state?
It will happen. It'll happen sooner than later.
Yeah.
I mean, it's great business. For the states, you know, the taxes and all that goes to, you know, and it's good for good for the populace in general. You know, it cools everybody out and brings them together in certain ways.
It's helped diminish
the... And it gets you high. And
That's
the most important thing.
Do you know, well, statistically, they're finding in areas where it is legal, the opioid issue has dropped, where people can do pain management with this.
Mm-hmm.
They're less inclined to be turning towards, grabbing somebody's prescription drugs or something or whatever, you know, leads to their particular case. So it's interesting to see that happen.
Yeah, that's opiate's dangerous.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, you know, you go down that road and it's not an easy road to come back.
Right.
Whereas smoking is a pleasure.
Yeah.
And it's very easy to do. And it's just been, you know, since 1937, it's been illegal. I mean, it was legal until then. And it's been grown around the world. It's 12,000 years old, cannabis. I mean, the history of it going back to China. So it in hemp. Pythagoras used it. Plato used it. Some of the greatest minds, thinkers in the history.
Well, how do you think it got them thinking in that direction?
Well, they were inhaling the fumes from the seeds and so forth. Yeah. You know, fires, you know, pits, yeah. fire pits and so forth. And it was a visionary thing. Yeah. So looking back into the historical record, you'll find most of the great thinkers were smoking... smoking cannabis and having visions, and that's how we got, you know, what we got.
I want to go back to the music real quick because you had mentioned something about not really knowing what you had played the day before, and I don't know if you're aware of this, but the last time that the Dead with Jerry played Philadelphia, you guys had played Unbroken Chain for the first time in Philadelphia ever.
Hmm.
Is that something that you were ever, as a band, ever aware of? Because as fans here in this, as fans here in the city, it was like, they played on Broken Chain, first time ever!
Not really.
Okay.
We don't really make the set list or anything or play those things because of that.
Mm-hmm.
It's just part of the cycle. It's part of what, you know, what comes up. I mean, they used to have signs saying, you know, Last Dark Star, 1,000 Days, or something like that.
Okay.
And then we would never give in to that. And then, of course, on the 1,007th, we would pop open Dark Star or something like that.
Right.
And we have so many songs. It was like we have 450 songs.
That's amazing.
So we could do a whole tour without repeating.
Right.
Well, many tours.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it's just... And we get tired of playing the same song over and over again.
What song are you most tired of?
Oh, Jesus, that's a good question. I'm a
huge fan of Grateful Dead. I'm also a huge fan of Fish. And Trey Anastasio had said, you know, like "You Enjoy Myself" was a song that he was just tired of. And then he got pinched by the cops. He was doing community service in the Vermont, you know, fairgrounds. And he at that moment he said, "Man, I would give my left nut to play You Enjoy Myself all, you know, every day for the rest of my life."
Yeah. So, well, I think we're at that point. You know, in the early days, it was like that, you know. But now, you know, every song is a good song if you play it well.
Yeah.
And I can't really think of a song that I, you know, don't want to play or I want to put away because we change up so many songs.
Okay.
So it's not like we play the same song the whole tour. That's ridiculous.
I've also heard artists...
In Grateful Dead world, that would be... that's suicidal.
Yeah. I've heard artists say also, but they're reticent to say things like that. What song they don't like because they know that for somebody in their fan base that means a lot, and then to hear the artist disconnect from it sort of robs it a little bit of its importance. I wanted to ask you, when did you become aware that, you know, that we think of the classic the hopping in a van and following the Dead tour? When did you become aware that was a thing where you were starting to have fans that were literally following you all around?
Well, we didn't really tour, I think, really until 68,
right,
something like that. And so once we started touring...
it happened immediately?
Mainly a San Francisco band.
Yeah. You know,
and we didn't like to cross borders for obvious reasons. So we stayed at home mostly and enjoyed ourselves outside of prison. But we noticed people.
That's great.
You know, we noticed people were, you know, following us, and then it became a caravan more and more, and then it became, you know, a scene in the parking lot.
Yeah,
and, you know, everybody was there selling their whatever.
A culture, a community,
culture, and they kind of defined themselves.
Yeah,
I mean, we didn't make Deadheads.
No,
they made themselves.
Well, I love that, like, because at Fish concerts as well, that area in the parking lot, it's called Shakedown Street.
That's what it's called, yeah.
It's called Shakedown
One
Street.
One of our records is called Shakedown Street. So they call it that, and it's a very friendly place. And you go there, and it's kind of like the gate into the Grateful Dead world.
I love it.
You can find out the ethos and so forth of the people and meet people. It's kind of... Somebody said something recently that kind of resonated with me. And they said, it feels like home when we go there.
Wow.
You know, and I started thinking, yeah, you got to know where home's at.
Yeah.
And so it's such a gathering place for ritualizing. And that's what Shakedown and what our conscience is supposed to be. They're supposed to be rituals to take you to another virtual place. In transport, you raise your consciousness. It's not so much about the dance.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It's about, you know, the changing of consciousness. But of course, the dancing is one great way of doing that.
Let me ask you, with the art and your painting, I mean, did people automatically take to it? Were you afraid you were going to get the here's a musician trying to be an, a painter sort of deal?
I'm not afraid.
Yeah. So what was that jump like, and how well were you received initially? Because I mean, honestly, we were looking at the stuff. It's pretty amazing looking.
There it is.
Yeah. So what was that initially like?
Well, I didn't think of it as. It's art.
You know, yeah, it is
came
art.
Out. It's right. you follow the muse. I mean, you're an artist, you know.
Right.
The thing that turns you on, makes you do things artistically. And first time I did it, I walked into the house, and my daughter looked at it, and he said, "You know, Dad, this got legs."
That's pretty good.
Legs. He liked it.
Yeah.
And so if my daughter liked it, and she didn't like much.
Does she like the dead? Does she like
that?
She, okay.
So I said, okay, I'll paint. If you like it, I'll paint it.
I don't like much.
And I love it. You know, I play music all day, or I'm involved in music. And then at night, I go into my my zone and I paint.
Yeah.
I paint
yeah.
at night. Okay. And it's kind of a synesthetic thing. You know, it's really synesthesia. I enjoy my synesthesia at night.
Well, who wouldn't?
You ever stay up all night doing it?
Yes, I do.
I believe it.
Yeah, you better believe it.
Yeah.
Because I do my best work before dawn.
Okay.
There you go.
Yeah, absolutely.
You can take a look for yourself and see Mickey Hart's work. It's called Vibrational Expressionism, The Art of Mickey Hart. And I do have one last request. When we get done here, can we jam off air a little quick?
You bet.
All right.
Yeah.
I love it. Excellent. I got some stuff for you. Ladies and gentlemen, please give some love to the one and only Mr. Mickey Hart.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming by, bro. We're going to take a break, and we will be back in just a moment. Make sure you stay with us.
93.3 WMMR presents Preston and Steve's Weekly Rush, a video highlights compilation gleaned from an entire week's worth of laughs. Available now in the Get Local section of Xfinity On Demand.
Now, bizarre. WMMR presents bizarre. Kristen and Steve's Bizarre File.
Brought to you by Dunkin' Donuts. New handcrafted espresso drinks from Dunkin' are amazing. Sipping is believing. Get any medium latte or cappuccino for $2 from 2 to 6 p.m. America runs on Dunkin'. Participation may vary. Limited time offer.
Well, an off-duty cop is in hot water after picking up a prostitute in Brooklyn and leaving her in his still-running car, his service weapon on the front seat, while he stopped to get some cash for their rendezvous. The hooker allegedly saw a golden opportunity when Officer Allie Shepard got out of his Jeep Wrangler to hit the ATM. She got behind the wheel and took off.
Can't even trust a hooker.
And while police have since caught the lady of the night and recovered Shepard's vehicle, his Smith & Wesson pistol is still missing out there somewhere.
Where's my gun?
Yeah, where did I leave that?
You're a bad hooker.
And even Shepard's dad couldn't believe his 38-year-old son, a U.S. Army veteran who's been a cop for the last 13 years, could be so boneheaded. When asked about it, he said, "You've got to be effing kidding me."
You always keep your gun on you when you're going to the ATM for hooker cash.
Dad Eugene Shepard said from his home that he shares with his police officer son. He said, "I'm in total shock. I would never have thought this. The man has been in the service twice. I've never heard that he would pick up a prostitute." Shepard allegedly hired Laquana Lawton, known as Unique, at Liberty Avenue and Sackman Street around 12:15 on Tuesday. They were headed to a motel, but Shepard made a quick pit stop to withdraw some cash from the ATM. That's when Lawton jumped behind the driver's seat and drove off with the firearm on the front seat. Police found Lawton, the jacked Jeep, and some narcotics and drug paraphernalia around 3 p.m. The gun was nowhere to be seen, so Shepard is now in a little bit of trouble from this incident. A University of North Florida dean has resigned after he allegedly engaged in a sex act on campus. And wait till you hear the scenario.
So boy.
The soccer coach called police and told them that he saw two individuals engaged in a sex act in a stairwell adjacent to the stadium's press box. Police said investigation revealed that Dr. Mark Tumio dean of the College of Computing, Engineering, and Construction, met someone on an internet application named Adam for Adam and agreed to meet him on campus. When questioned, Tumio told police that he was just there to talk to the man about his bat business, according to the report.
I'd really like to meet you in the stairwell to discuss your bat business.
He told police the man may have been bending down to tie his shoe, and that may have looked out of place, apparently.
Well, yeah. It's a misunderstanding.
After telling Tumio that the man admitted to their sexual encounter, Tumio told officers he was there to engage in some oral. The man was issued a trespass warning.
Dr. Mark, I can't talk right now.
And Tumio was, had resigned, according to school officials. So he was.
Wait a second. Here you have a guy who's really trying to explore bat options for the team.
I mean, come on. You know?
All right. Gets in hot water.
Waiting for a letter that never arrived, possibly? Well, it may have ended up dumped by a U.S. Postal Service worker along a South Jersey street. A Facebook post...
You're supposed to deliver that stuff, right?
...shared more than 3,000 times shows a dozen mail bins stuffed with items discarded off of River Road in Pensauken. The mail, discovered Sunday, was dated August 8th and for delivery from the Roxborough Station post office. Oops. Agents tracked down the employee who threw out the mail but learned that the person resigned from the post service back in on September 8th.
You ever just look at one mailbox and think about all the life-changing potential letters that are in one mailbox?
Absolutely.
And things that people are desperately waiting for.
So this guy quit and just dumped all the mail. Authorities did not identify the worker or a possible motive for the bizarre incident. So they
it's
got
a felony.
It.
Yeah.
I actually spent an entire summer painting mailboxes because my mom had nobody asked me to. My mom worked for the post office, so I'd actually I would wash the vehicles from time to time, and then I also painted mailboxes, and that paint is like super thick. I don't even know what kind of paint it is, but so that was an entire summer. It was good money, cash money.
Nice.
Back to you, Preston.
All righty, then. I'll take the floor.
Careers in mailbox painting.
A 90-year-old
I am Michael Bolton, and I'd like to tell you about the career opportunities available in the world of mailbox painting. I know last time I was talking about cows, but they seem to be better now.
That's good.
Okay.
I'll move on.
Okay.
Are you sure? Because I got this now.
I am Michael Bolton. What are you doing next summer? How about painting mailboxes? Casey says the paint is very thick.
Okay. A 90-year-old California man was charged in the death of his stepdaughter after authorities said they found key evidence through the woman's Fitbit. Tying the man to her murder. Listen to how this played out. It's a terrible story, by the way. Anthony Vincent Aiello was arrested in the death of Karen Navarra, who was found dead inside her home in San Jose. Navarra was discovered slumped in a wooden chair while clutching a kitchen knife in her right hand.
Jeez.
Leading authorities to initially believe that she may have killed herself. Now, an autopsy later revealed Navarra's suicide was staged. She had multiple deep and intrusive wounds to her facial area and a head that caused skull fractures, along with a gaping slit to her neck. Authorities ruled that the 67-year-old woman's death homicide after finding that she couldn't have self-inflicted the wounds, which were most likely caused by a small hatchet or axe. Now, police interviewed Aiello and found his account of September 8th, the day Navarra died, didn't match up to evidence found on security footage. Aiello claimed that he was... that he went by his stepdaughter's house to drop off a pizza. He spotted her driving by his home later in the day. Security footage, however, showed that his car was parked at her house from 3:12 to 3:30 p.m. Okay, 3:33 p.m. Navarra's car wasn't seen leaving the home. Hmm. So police also found a Fitbit device on Navarra. They contacted Fitbit and they got the data. They discovered that her heartbeat spiked at 3:20 p.m. and then slowed down and stopped registering at 3:28. So they had
the time of
the attack and the time of death.
Oof, dear God.
Her Fitbit. And this was the same time frame that his vehicle was seen at her house.
You know, that's going to, Casey, with the Apple Watches now, mm-hmm. they have even a more thorough suite of things like the Fitbit. So you're going to find this data being used in investigations more and more.
Yeah. ALO attempted to provide an explanation for investigators' new discovery, saying that he couldn't have been with his stepdaughter when she was killed because she had walked him to his vehicle. Mm. He denied that he was present when she was killed and suggested that someone else might have been in the house. But authorities said they also located blood-stained clothes at his house, though he claimed that the blood was from him frequently cutting himself. He was arrested on suspicion of murder last week. He's held without bond. This dude killed her.
Yes.
And they had the evidence. So that's pretty wild. I'd never heard of a Fitbit being used as evidence. But you're right, Steve. You'll see more and more of that stuff popping up. All right. And there you go. That's what I have in the B-Pop for you this morning. We'll be back in just a moment. Stay with us.
93.3 WMMR presents Jackson's Local Shots Artist of the Month. The Captain, the Pilot, the Driver. Celebrating our area's best talent. Bringing it to you on air, online, and in the community. Click Local Shots at WMMR.com to see and hear more. The Captain, the Pilot, the Driver. Jackson's Local Shots Artist of the Month. Sponsored by Family and Company Jewelers. Find a band that rocks your world at Family. 93.3 WMMR. Everything that rocks.
What's going on this morning, Kathy? Steve.
I was like, oh my God, what am I supposed to do?
What am I? I have to trash now? I can't do that!
Isn't that funny?
I'm thrown off because we traffic in this break, and I'm not used to it. And Steve, what's going on?
I'll take this one.
All right.
Farrah Abraham revealing in a recent interview that she despises her Teen Mom OG replacement, Bristol Palin. Abraham says it's not a case of her being a tight ass, mainly because the muscles that control her ass were long ago rendered useless by relentless butt porn.
Oh. Whoa. Oh.
Meghan Markle's estranged half-sister Samantha Markle says that despite showing up unannounced to Kensington Palace in a failed attempt to meet with Meghan, she felt her trip to London was a success. Samantha says regardless of everything, she did get to meet a cousin of the guy who played Mr. Belvedere.
Oh, my God.
That's pretty cool. And finally, Lenny Dykstra has been indicted by a grand jury in Union City, New Jersey for possession of cocaine, possession of meth, and making terroristic threats after an altercation with an Uber driver last May. Dykstra vehemently denies the allegations and says that when the facts come out, he'll be curious to see what happened.
Yeah. And
that's your Hollywood trap.
Our next guest came down to our Camp Out for Hunger one year and helped support us in that event. Please welcome the one and only Tom Green.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Good to be here. Great to be back in Philadelphia. Amazing. Exciting. I just posted a picture of your comic book on my Instagram.
Oh, you like that cover?
That's a cool comic book.
That's pretty cool, right? Somebody did a series of comics for us a while ago, but that's of a what-if comic book.
Yeah, that's cool. I'm kind of into that. My girlfriend's an illustrator. She draws comic books.
Really? Is she the one that did your profile picture on Twitter and Instagram?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's really cool.
Very cool.
Yeah.
So what are you into?
What's
like
that?
Like Marvel, DC?
Well, me personally, I just kind of like look at when she's drawn stuff. And, you know, I'm not totally, you know,
geeked
that well versed in comics, but I can tell that that's a really good one.
Yeah.
I sent it to her.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, she's Secret Crayon on Instagram. I'm Tom Green on Instagram. You can go look at my Daddy Would You Like Some Sausage. my Daddy Would You Like Some Sausage drawing that she did.
Yes. That's what that is?
Yeah,
from Freddy Got Fingered.
It's sort of a... kind of a depiction of a scene from my movie Freddy Got Fingered, my critically acclaimed film.
I'm going to tell you this, Tom. I've revisited Freddy Got Fingered, and then initially, I was less than thrilled with it. And over the years, it has become something that I really enjoy, especially this scene where your father in the movie is just to the end of his rope.
Yeah.
And you are there sitting playing what appears to be like a Casio piano.
Uh-huh.
Loads of strings attached to your fingers, going up over hooks, and at the end of the strings on the other side, the sausages.
Yeah, yeah.
And you keep
I made that.
Yeah, you made that?
I had a pulley system. Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, it's a visual movie. There's lots of outrageous visual scenes and physical stunts. I wrote and directed the whole movie, you know.
I will say that people need to, if you have not spent some time at Freddy Got Fingered recently, you need to.
It's gotten a
is there a cult?
It's gotten a bit of a worldwide cult fanatic following now.
I'll tell you what you did. It was brilliant, by the way, because when you got the Razzie, I believe you showed up to accept, correct?
I did, yeah. Yes. Absolutely. We're first person to do that. Yeah.
Which was very cool.
Me. Halle Berry copied me.
Yes.
It's the only time Halle Berry's copied anything I've done.
Not Monsters Ball or anything?
No.
I'll tell you this, though. Again, it's, you know what? The same could be said for, and we told Will Ferrell this. There have been movies that he's been in, the initial watching, you're like, eh, okay. And then you see it a few more times, and then you start to say, oh, okay, now it's clicking.
Well, you know, I think the reason that it received a critical backlash is actually the reason why people like it, is because the movie's completely insane.
Okay.
And so, you know, whenever you do something that is shocking or outrageous or polarizing like that, which was purposefully what we did, you know, I purposely wanted the movie to upset and confuse people.
It's like a
more confuse people, really. I like confusing people.
Confused.
And so it did. It confused the critics, I think. It confused the people, and they didn't know how to respond to it. And when your job is to write a review of a movie,
right,
and the movie involves, you know, sausages and you know, wrapping yourself up in roadkill and, you know, all sorts of bizarre. And, you know, it's almost, I think you feel obligated as a writer to say that it's depraved and there's something wrong with it. So, but then people, I don't think that way. I think they just sort of, if they see something interesting or that confuses them or intrigues them, I think they tend to like it.
I think you're right.
Sometimes, as opposed to dislike it.
And sometimes movies like that are ahead of their time or just not released at the right time, you know, and they find an audience later. And I was just reminded because I looked at your Instagram account, there's a couple of photos of you wearing a Letterman jacket. You know, you're a huge Letterman fan. Yeah. And I recently rewatched Cabin Boy, in which Dave makes a cameo. I didn't get Chris Elliott until much later on, but now I think he's a comedic genius. And I feel like there's a part of me that's like, well, I missed the boat earlier on in Chris Elliott. You know,
The man under the stairs.
The stairs is great.
I loved him. Man.
I don't think I got it.
Yeah.
Cabin Boy is a great thing to point out, Nick, because that's one of those that I immediately took to that. I'll tell you why Freddie Got Fingered would succeed now, because that was well ahead of the YouTube stupid viral video with no direct, just sort of stream of consciousness sort of comedy that is now commonplace. I think that's why it would succeed now, to Nick's point about timing. You know,
I think everybody's palate changes. It's not, you know, much different from foods you didn't like when you were a kid and then foods that you can eat now. Case in point, I had meatloaf this this past week, and I loved it, but I couldn't stand it as a child. So, you know, maybe we just, you know, there are just certain things that we
personally... Freddie Got Fingered, it's like meatloaf.
Go back and try it. You might like it now.
No, you know...
I was a skateboarder, and I always was into sort of non-commercial things.
Yeah.
Before I was making the show, the Tom Green Show, I was into... You know, punk rock music and hip hop music back before it was cool. And, you know, I was kind of always into sort of doing stuff that people weren't really into. And so, you know, I think there was sort of this sort of anti nonconformist kind of thing that was going on. And so when the show was thrust into the mainstream, you know,
was
on
huge.
MTV, you know, all of a sudden we had people watching it that were, you know, normal people,
right?
Normal people who like normal things.
Right.
And that maybe was, you know, a little bit confusing for them.
Well, but it also thrust you into the stratosphere because then you became the darling of people who had been waiting for something like that. I mean, the great Ernie Kovacs years ago is, you know, he did stuff that people just didn't get and he's a legend. But I mean, the list of things that you did on that show that blew our collective minds immediately, you know, is a super long list.
It's
the statues of your parents having sex. You know, this is brilliant.
They were mad about that.
Yeah,
that one almost broke your relationship with your parents.
They called MTV. My father called MTV, and he threatened on the answering machine, which I still can't believe they had an answering machine. But somehow he found the number that had an answering machine.
Yeah,
because we played the recording back on the show.
Yeah, right. Tom
threatened
had...
to sue them, you MTV bleep, for $1 million. He said, you know, which is Canadian dollars.
Canadian dollars.
$700,000.
Tom created these life-size statues of people having graphic sex, yeah. and he set them up on his parents.
It was actually my parents. Yeah.
Front, it was them.
It was them.
On their front yard. Front lawn. One of them was like a doggy style type thing and had a, there was a, an actual fountain,
fountain.
That came out of the money shot area. And it was just, it was a scream.
I think they were particularly upset about that because I'd been doing pranks to them for years, on them for years. And then when MTV picked up the show, I moved down to New York City. And they were so happy for me and relieved because I was gone. And assumed that the pranks had ended. But now we had a budget. You know, we had an MTV budget now. Yes. Budget to make statues.
You know, you were a precursor. There would there have been no
Jackass.
Bam Margera, Jackass.
Right.
I mean, that you clearly opened the door on all of that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, the only, by the way, the only reason that sex statues thing aired was because... Because they weren't going to let us air it. And then Oprah invited my parents and I on her show for her Mother's Day special.
Whoa.
This is how, this how weird my life got in 1999. And so when I was, we all flew to Chicago. Up until that moment, my mother had not been talking to me because of the sex statues bit that you brought up. And so we go on Oprah, and then after then Oprah surprised my parents and said that she was going to send them to Tahiti. So she gave them tickets to Tahiti.
Wow.
And then we went out for dinner in Chicago that night, and I pulled a release form out of my back pocket and got my parents to sign the release form
brilliant.
So we could air the sex statues bit.
Oh, my God.
So thank you, Oprah.
Oprah buttered him up. Oh, my God.
Well, let me ask you, because I have three kids, but my son in particular, he does things to me that I would, like, I don't even get mad at. I really don't, but it's so disrespectful. And, and he's been taken to farting in my face lately.
Yeah.
And
how does that, I don't want to even.
Well,
I don't need details.
You don't need details, but, you know, I would never fart in my dad's face.
Yeah.
I would never think to fart in my dad's face.
Trouble.
I'm like, this little kid, but. I said, okay, well, I'm going to fart in your face now. You know, like, since this is a thing that we're allowed to do, I'm going to now hold you down and fart in your face.
Wow. Well, you have a lucrative career here for Tom Green. Are you prepared to potentially stifle that, or you're going to encourage it?
Well, I don't know. I don't know what the right thing to do is here.
Your parents...
How old is your...
He's 10.
Okay. Yeah. Well, you know, sounds like a lot of fun. I don't have any kids yet.
But, it's tough to, like, create boundaries because sometimes I go, yo, dude. Like, so when I ask him to go to bed and he doesn't go to bed, I'm like, got to respect your father. But your father also lets you fart in his face.
Yeah.
So
now he's going to be like, no, it's I'm not going
to. Does he listen to the radio show?
Well, he's in school right now, but he does listen to the radio show.
Well, maybe that's why. He assumes it's okay. Yeah. He hears you're going to do a crazy show and you're a crazy guy and you do fun stuff. So, yeah. But your father probably, you know, was a little more respectable than you, I bet.
You know what? You're right.
You're exactly right. Yeah. By leaps and bounds. Yeah.
I remember when you started to get a little too popular, and I was actually a little disappointed because your stuff was just so funny. How did you take to that popularity?
Well, when the show was on in New York, like when we were living in New York, it was kind of got harder to film some of the bits on the street.
Yeah.
Because that's the liability. You become recognized.
Because you'd go out and you'd sort of want to pull, you know, a prank on someone and they'd sort of be excited.
Yeah.
It was you.
So that kind of affected the ability to shoot in the city. So that's when the show moved out to Los Angeles, because we found that in L.A. you could sort of get in a van with tinted windows and drive around until you saw somebody who looked, you know, too old to be watching MTV, and then just get out and make fun of them.
Be a little bit more surgical about it. So while you're out in L.A., obviously and then you were in a number of films. Road Trip is one of our favorites, and Charlie's Angels. You got a fair amount of film work. Was that from where you were coming from, which is so avant-garde, and you were basically the main chef? Was that a little frustrating? Because we hear film work is hurry up and wait.
That wasn't too bad. I mean, Road Trip, it was exciting and fun.
Trip was a good experience.
Road Trip was the first movie I really did after the show was on MTV. So it was directed and written by Todd Phillips, who did the Hangover movies.
He's great, yeah.
So this was his first feature film. And, you know.
You were Tom Green-esque in it.
Yeah, I mean, there's a scene where I have to feed a mouse to a snake in the movie, and the mouse, for whatever reason, ends up in my mouth. That wasn't actually in the script.
Really?
Yeah. You know, you can see when I'm, you see where I'm holding the mouse?
Yeah, there? Yeah,
you
know, yeah.
Looking at the screen. Mm-hmm. You see how it kind of grabs my lip like that?
Yeah, yeah.
I sort of, that just sort of happened. We were improvising. And I realized it kind of wanted to go in there, so I just let it go in there.
Oh, my God.
But, you know, I'd never been in a movie before, and Ivan Reitman was one of the producers of the movie, or the producer of the movie, and, you know, I'm looking at Ivan Reitman on the set, and I got a mouse in my mouth, and I'm thinking, you know, am I doing a good job? Am I acting good here?
Was that one take?
Yeah, well, you know, the first take was one take, but then they made me do it 30 more times.
Oh, man. Now, mice crap all the time.
I didn't know you had to do that, you know.
Yeah,
mice are just crap machines.
Well, it did. Yeah. Crapped in your mouth. I saw the outtake footage.
There's a little salty sort of enjoyment
there. Actually, one of my favorite scenes in that movie is
I'm
when
fine with all that.
You're singing a song, and it's just this wild song that it feels like you're just making up, but then at one point, I think Sean William Scott is now singing along with it.
Yeah, yeah. The salmon song.
Yes.
That's right.
Yeah, tiny salmon swimming in a stream.
Mm-hmm.
The minor bird says, ah, ah. Yeah, yeah. I wrote that. I asked me if they said there's a, Todd said, you know, there's a scene where you're going to have a guitar and then beginning the next scene, you want to do a little song, and I wrote the song about 5 minutes before the
perfect.
As you can probably tell when you listen to it, it was written quickly. But
hey, you've covered some serious stuff over the years. Your testicular cancer was documented on the Tom Green Show.
Yeah.
How's your ball now?
It's good.
Good.
Yeah. Well, the one is good.
Yeah.
That was right around the
Did
time.
You save the other one?
I took the right one. I still have the left one. It's the middle one now. It's the middle one. Actually, it's the left one. It's the one that's left. Thank you.
No, but you probably, going through that, you probably saved some lives as well. You got people to get out and get checked.
Yeah, I have had a lot of guys come to my shows, you know, when I travel around the country, who come up to me after the show and say they went and got their... got checked after they saw the special.
Isn't that a wild thing to think they're...
Sometimes it's a very emotional sort of meeting I have with these cancer survivors after my shows because they went to the doctor because they saw the show on MTV. Because, you know, it's testicular cancer. It only affects, like, guys, obviously, but, like, young guys, surprisingly young guys, like 15-year-old guys can get that. And so they were watching my show on MTV. 15 to 35 is really the age that you get that. You know, if you're that age, you don't really expect you're going to get cancer, so you feel something wrong. You don't. Sometimes you're embarrassed. You don't go to the doctor. But I think sort of a positive outcome from that.
That's
whole
cool.
experience. Yeah.
I wanted to ask. I saw in your left hand there, you've got bruised fingernails.
Yeah.
What did you do?
Yeah. I could lie and say I was working on my roof or doing something real manly, hammering something, which is what I often do when people ask me. But what happened was I slammed my hand in a car door during a night of heavy drinking in Prince Edward Island, Charlottetown, Prince Edward Island. So, yeah, I went out after one of my shows in Prince Edward Island. I had a couple of days off in Canada, and I thought, I wandered into a local dive bar and had a few shots of this stuff you got here, Fireball. Yeah.
And that was it.
And I ended up kind of getting a lift home for the bartender, actually offered me a lift home.
Wow, so you were there that late. You closed it out.
Yeah. And then we were driving back to the hotel, and he said, there's a great Chinese food place here. So I got out to get some Chinese food, and I slammed the car door, and I felt my hand. How do you slam
your own hand
in a car door?
Yeah.
So that was about 3 months ago, actually.
Okay.
And that's clearing up pretty good.
Excruciating pain.
Yeah, it's pretty fun on the road, though. You know, we have a good time. You know, I don't drink every night, but I definitely
you partake.
Well, you know, whenever I have a day off the next day, I always try to have some fun and get out and have a good time.
To that drinking thing, let me ask you, because a lot has been made recently, obviously, because Donald Trump's president. You were on Celebrity Apprentice with Donald Trump. He fired you.
Yeah.
But to me, the more
interesting aspect of that story is you went out drinking with Dennis Rodman,
yeah.
which led to your being fired.
On the night I was the project manager.
So,
it's a serious position.
So, what is it
pretty
like?
Disrespectful to the president.
Partying with Dennis Rodman, who we just see as this mess lately.
Well, I heard he's doing well.
Is he doing well?
I saw on TMZ that he's sober all right. now. So, look, Dennis was a very cool dude, man.
Was he a cool dude?
He was a nice guy. And, obviously everyone has, not everyone, but people have issues. And
yeah.
He had an issue with alcohol, I guess. It's been quite public about that. But, how do you explain this? You know, these reality shows are weird, right? Like, they put you in a situation with a bunch of, people, and everybody is very sort of stressed out and not very nice to each other. And Rodman and I kind of hit it off because I think he'd done a few of these reality-type shows before. I've been on television.
Right.
We kind of were maybe more media aware of what was going on. So it was kind of, whereas, you had a lot of the other guys, like Scott Hamilton and Clint Black and Jesse James and Herschel Walker and whoever else was on there. Everyone was all mad at each other, And so it kind of became a little bit annoying, to be honest with you, being on the show and getting sort of yelled at every day by people, who are upset because you weren't making the cupcakes properly or some stupid reality show challenge.
Yeah. I've heard people describe Dennis Rodman as sweet.
But yeah, he was nice. So at the end of the day, one day, the camera was rolling on us.
Right.
You want to go out drinking tonight? And I'm like, yeah, let's go. Knowing that this was not going to be a good thing. So I got fired the next day. By the president.
Right? He double fired
you. Yeah, he was mad at me. He screamed at me. The day I got fired, I wrote a letter to the president of the United States. And I wrote a letter on the Trump Tower stationery because we were staying at Trump Tower. And I said, Mr. Trump, I know I went out drinking last night the other night when I was the project manager. And I know that probably wasn't the most business-like decision to make, but I'm a comedian, and this is a television show, and I wanted to do something entertaining for the show because I want the show to be successful. And so, I want you to be successful with the show. Best wishes with the season this year. Thanks for having me on or something like that. So I got a call the next day from the producers, and they say, Mr. Trump really appreciated your letter. And and they brought me back. They brought me back on the show. Oh. Now, and they always bring people back at the end who've been fired previously. But,
yes.
But they never bring someone back who was fired in the third episode. So I think I have the distinction of being the earliest person to get fired to get brought back. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's anomalous.
It was interesting hanging out with the president, I know the president.
It's weird.
The president knows me.
Have you looked to parlay that? Have you dropped by 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue?
I don't know that I'd be... welcomed with open arms.
Okay.
At this point,
it seems that you ended on a good note.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, I don't really talk publicly about politics too much.
Yeah, we stay away from.
Yeah,
it.
Yeah, I'm Canadian. This is your problem. But I do mention it in the show. I have some fun talking a little bit about. I just did the Comedy Central Storyteller. This Is Not Happening show on Comedy Central. They posted a clip of me talking about my experience on
Ari Shaffir's show, right?
Yeah. He's got a new host now. Actually, Roy Wood Jr. is hosting it now.
Yes. Yeah.
So, but Ari's great. Anyway, so that's up on Facebook now. You can see me doing stand up and talking a bit about that. There it is, right there. You got it on the web stream. So So that's actually it's kind of cool when you know the president. it's fodder for a good story.
The president knows you.
Yeah, anyone who knows me should probably not be president.
Hey, you know what? Casey just pointed out something you mentioned. Do you still play guitar at all?
Just a little bit. Yeah,
we have a guitar. Do you want to make up a song on the spot? Or
I'm not a very good guitar player, but I mean, a nice Martin there. I have a Martin. Yeah,
I do.
Yeah. I might be able to sing Tiny Salmon Swimming in a Stream.
Oh, please. We'd be honored.
I have no idea if it's in tune or not.
We'll find out.
I won't be able to.
This mic over here.
Do you need it tuned for Tiny Salmon?
In fact, slightly out of tune might be good.
Tiny salmon swimming in a stream.
salmon chasing the impossible dream. The minor bird says, ah! Ah! The chimpanzee says, the friendly owl says, ooh, ooh. But the salmon can only say, bloop, 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 bloop. And that's sad.
Yes!
There you go.
You still got it.
Probably in 10 years.
Wow.
It's like somebody, the Who in Woodstock.
Somebody told me, have you remember that song, What Does the Fox Say?
Yes.
Yes.
Somebody told me that about that song. They said they thought it was a ripoff of the Slam
Song.
It
is.
It is.
Content-wise, it's very similar.
I don't know. I'm not bitter.
You know the president.
So are you enjoying, so stand-up is you know, it's the center of what you're doing now. Is your ultimate passion? Doing
I love it. I started doing stand-up 30 years ago, actually, when I was a teenager.
Right.
In
At Yuck Canada, Yucks?
At Yuck Yucks in Ottawa, Canada.
Yeah.
And I loved it then. I stopped when I was doing college radio at the time. I went back to school, studied broadcasting, stopped doing stand-up, started my show on public access, and kind of always missed doing it, but just got so focused on making the TV show for years that I did that. But I started up again about 10 years ago. And it was the best decision I ever made, I think, in my adult life to get back into doing stand-up.
Gives you the most freedom.
Yeah, and I've gotten to tour the whole world. You know, the cool thing about MTV is they put the show out around the world. So, like, last year I was, performed in Israel for the first time.
Really?
Yeah, I was in all over the UK. I've been in Australia, and I've really gotten to see, I've done USO tours. I went to Iraq and Afghanistan. And
where you received the best of all the countries?
Afghanistan,
here,
probably.
Afghanistan.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I was in Afghanistan. I did a show for the Taliban over there. So
the Taliban loved you.
Yeah. No, it was a military.
Did you tell that Trump story?
Yeah. No, I mean, I think it's honestly the exciting thing about touring is it's a fun thing doing stand up.
Yeah,
people come out to have fun. So I get a great response all over. I mean, I love being in the US. I mean, Americans do tend to have a little bit more, they wear their enthusiasm on their sleeve a little more than like in England and Canada. Everyone has a good time, but people are a little bit more reserved. Yeah, I mean, the shows this weekend in Philadelphia are going to be insane. You know, last time I played at Helium, the shows were just insane.
This is a
comedy town,
yep.
And people, know how to have a good time. And, I think there's a confidence, up here on the East Coast in New York and Philly.
I agree,
where people are kind of a little bit more outgoing in a way where, they vocalize it with their laughter.
Yeah.
In a way. So these are, it is great everywhere. I have a great time everywhere. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, listen, before we wrap it up, I do want to read a text that came in about Freddie Got Fingered. It says, hey, Tom, I was talking about Freddie Got Fingered. I have a story about that. When the movie was coming out, my friends and I just smoked a bunch of weed. And we're sitting in my basement flipping through the TV channels. And for a brief moment, as they were changing channels, I saw sausages hanging from a string while someone was playing the piano. And it was amazing. And the person was still flipping through the channels. And I said, go back. And that conversation took forever. So by the time they went back, it was in a commercial because we couldn't find it. And no one ever believed that I actually saw a guy with sausages on his fingers playing the piano. They thought I was nuts, and unfortunately, they still don't believe me.
Oh,
to this
my gosh.
Day.
Wow. Well, so, I can confirm that it happened.
It really happened. It really is there. Well, listen, Tom, thanks so much, man. We love you.
Thank you. Thank you. I love you guys. Thank you.
Tom Green, everybody.
New, old, and everything in between. MMR rocks.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most of us, Keith Urban also has a bucket list. You may be surprised to learn what is and is not on his. Text Keith to 45911 to read and learn more about the central theme of Keith's bucket list. Get a link to the story sent right to your phone when you text Keith to 45911. Go inside country music at BackstageCountry.com.